You are now in the audience room.
It's going to be after the morning break. We'll pass that during the break.
Can you bring it up a little bit?
something? Hey, bring it up. Bring it up.
Up all the way.
Game two?
Yep. Nothing. Pretty much all the way. Don't have a lot of weeks if they don't work.
Better bring the top hatch down a little bit. Better bring the patch down a little bit.
Good.
There you go.
Thank you. Good morning. We'd like to begin the session, so could you please take your seats? Good morning. Hope you had a nice evening. I know there was great discussion at dinner last night, and that's typically where great discussion always happens. To begin the day, I want to wish Bruce Hansen, and we can all wish Bruce Hansen a happy birthday. And I'd like to welcome Dr. Joseph Selby, who's going to do some Q&A with you in just a few minutes. He is a new grandpa, and he doesn't let us forget that. Yes. And what? Yes. Yes. Pictures are. Oh, absolutely.
Happy birthday, Pastor.
I think that was Regina. And I'd like to welcome those on the phone. This is day two of the advisory panel on patient engagement. And we're going to just do a brief recap for those of you who were not with us yesterday of what we did yesterday. And then we will welcome Joe to answer questions that you have and share the direction where PCORI's going in the future. So just yesterday, briefly, I mean, we all know here at the table what we did, but we spent quite a bit of time going over the rubric and spoke about how the rubric has evolved from the patient and family engagement rubric to just the engagement rubric that includes examples of other stakeholders now in the rubric to really encourage our applicants and our merit reviewers to really look for this type of engagement. We talked about the engagement officer and you provided some really nice input into how do we measure the success of the engagement officer. So going forward, we'll internally create some of those metrics, and when we're with you again, we'll share those with you. We then went into the WEAN Act, and I got really nice response from you that the WEAN Act tool that's going to help us develop the science of engagement. So we covered that as well. And in the afternoon, we talked about our new direction in large pragmatic studies. And Joe, I think, is going to touch more on that and just kind of a new direction for PCORI. We then spoke about the pipeline to proposals and some feedback and some progress on our first tier one and then the expansion of our offices regionally and our national office as well. And then we talked about our ambassador program. How do we enhance and what are the next steps in the ambassador program? Now we have ambassadors, and what do we do next? Do we expand? Do we cautiously expand? Do we look at cross-fertilizing with FDA and IHI and CMS and others who are also seeking skilled, trained patient voices? And so we had some nice breakouts yesterday, and staff will begin to look at how we embed your recommendations into our ambassador program. So that is a recap of yesterday. I thank you all for your energy, your vision. Thank you for pushing PCORI into, to refine these programs that together we created. So with that, I'm going to invite Joe to the microphone. And I'm going to invite you. I hope you thought about questions you might have for Joe. Last time we had this discussion, it was really robust. So please don't hold back. And if you want to make a question or ask Joe something, please use your cards. And Regina, I think you're on the phone. And so when we go around the table once, then I'll invite you to ask a question.
Thank you.
Okay, and if no one has a question at the top of their head, Joe, you might want to just start out by just sharing the grown-up PCORI and some of the new direction that we're taking.
Yes, well, first of all, good morning, everybody, and very nice to see you all again and see you continuing into maturity as it feels like PCORI is. There has been a real... it feels like a transition over the last 6 months. We have a lot of research in the field. We've done many things now several times. We're kind of evolving, as Sue said, our research agenda and the portfolio of funded projects that go with that, and I'll say a bit more. People have gotten to know us better by virtue of all the activities, research, engagement, activities. PCORI is becoming, I wouldn't say it's a household name by any stretch, but, you know, in the right circles, PCORI is known, and you go a lot of places and they will say, I know of a PCORI project in our community. So that's very exciting. Part of the transition is a transition in a direction that we pretty much always knew that we would be going, we moved there deliberately because we wanted to be able to say that particularly as we began spending larger and larger amounts on individual projects and individual conditions, we wanted to have a very clear path through all of our stakeholders, patients and all the stakeholders, through our advisory panels in particular, to explain how we got there and how we chose this and did not choose that. So that took a long time both to really think through what are we looking for and how do we get it, and then to put it in place. And then to go through probably the most frustrating thing is you've got a fabulous idea and you're 100% convinced that it's just the right thing that you want to fund research in. And even though we've really shortened the period from, you know, having the fabulous idea to getting projects funded, it still takes about 9 or 10 months. So that is... when you're only 3.5 years old, it's very frustrating to know that it's going to be 9-10 months before you have anything funded. But we're getting close. And the direction is that we are going towards bigger studies in selected areas. And as I said, many people thought we would be going in exactly that direction from day one and criticized us for not. We are extremely proud of the way that we went. We went small, and we did not we didn't fund a $15 million project before we knew what engagement or patient-centered research actually meant. We learned to do engagement in smaller projects, and now we are taking it to the next level. And these pragmatic clinical studies are distinguished by their budgets. They're up to $15 million in total costs, maybe even bigger if we decided to collaborate with some other agency and co-fund it. They focus on very high-priority topics. We've specified a number of them. The IOM specified a number of them. ARC has specified a number of them in the past. And these topics are the kind of topics that when you look at them, you know that there are outstanding questions about whether these treatments work better than other treatments and questions about who benefits from these treatments and who actually stands to be harmed as much by them as helped. So that's where we're getting to, topics like medical versus surgical treatment for carotid artery disease or for aneurysms in the thoracic, the chest part of the aorta, the huge blood vessel there. treatments for multiple sclerosis. There are 12 new treatments for multiple sclerosis, relatively new treatments, and really precious little guidance on what's the best treatment to start with, what's the best combination of treatments, what do you do if one fails, what's the next step, how long should you take these very potent agents. Topics like that, one that's come up that we will be addressing in a workshop, a very multi-stakeholder workshop in mid-October, is hepatitis C, the new treatments for hepatitis C, and how we make decisions about the use of these agents. That's extraordinarily complex, and there are a lot of patients. A lot of these patients are hard to reach. There are a lot of vulnerable patient populations have an excess of hepatitis C. So those kinds of topics are bigger, and I think that really is very relevant to this group because when we were studying patient navigators or when we were studying community health workers or when we were studying shared decision making, it was kind of a no-brainer that you would have to have patients as your collaborators. When we move to these bigger topics, you can bet that they will be led in part by very well-known, accomplished researchers who've been doing research longer than patient engagement has been being talked about. And on the one hand, we're protected by the fact that we say you will not score well and you will absolutely not get funded unless you are engaged with the right patients and the right patient organizations, the right physician organizations, and if there are other organizations, payer organizations, industry, you'll be partnered with them. We're not going to fund the old style of research where someone sits in an academic office and accepts $15 million and conducts the study that they've always dreamt about, but that really no one else thinks is particularly the right study. But even having said that, even though we demand all this, we're going to be dealing with people who are overwhelmed at getting studies off the ground and, as I said, inexperienced. So I think taking what we've learned about patient engagement and stakeholder engagement to this new level, to the level PCORI was always expected to address, is our real challenge. Our next challenge is preserving what we've learned and what we've come to believe is critically important when we move to these topics. So that's the next chapter that's just opening, and the first projects will actually be awarded early in 2015. The reviews are in November. It'll take some time to digest the review scores, and they'll be announced probably in February. So, Sue, I'll stop there and see if there are some questions. I love questions.
So I'm going to leave it up to you, Peep. I know that you've got questions for Joe. And because last time we got together with Joe, we had to stop mid-conversation because we were overwhelming Joe with questions. So, Lorraine, you can start the questions. And for those of you thinking about your question, hopefully you can formulate something while Lorraine's talking.
So one question I have, I think it's great that we're doing really large studies. And one of the questions I have is, what is the role of the patient in helping to guide subgroup analysis? One of the reasons I ask that is because when you're dealing with a condition like MS, where response to treatment is highly variable, it may not be whether the average works, but whether it works for this particular subgroup.
Actually, that is so true of MS. That there are some people who say, there are many people who say you could not do a clinical trial in MS because no clinician or patient is going to be willing to sort of guide their therapy for a period of time on the flip of a coin. They believe it is so individualized that it's really the way you should do it is almost these N-of-1 trials. You know, every individual is their own trial, and you try something until you find what works for them. So there are some people, really respected scientists who think a trial would be impossible, and they're not sure whether there are comparative effectiveness studies at this point. But it's absolutely true. One of the reasons we've raised the price tag on these studies is precisely that they need to be pretty big so that you can look at heterogeneity of treatment effects. That only a portion of any population is likely to benefit, and you need to have enough people that you can find the benefit in the subgroup who does. Even if there's not much of a benefit overall, there may be a subgroup who really looks like this is the best thing available for them. So patients will clearly have a role in that. I should have said, too, I know you guys have talked about this, that we really have called out patient organizations in these announcements as well, because if we're going to make this kind of investment, we want findings to be we want to be ready to disseminate findings when they come out. So we want the patient organizations there, along with the right medical specialty organizations from the beginning. Laurel.
Good morning. I'm wondering about rare diseases, which don't have a large population, and yet they're very difficult to for funding, apparently, and they won't be part of the pragmatic trials. So where will they fall into this?
Well, they certainly could be a part of pragmatic trials. Now, the rarer the condition, to some extent, the less likely it is. But, for example, I know that we have an application this time on sickle cell disease. And I think I'm recalling that's about the rarest one that's in there. But I think sickle cell disease does actually qualify by the WHO criteria as a rare disease. We have a special interest in funding research in rare diseases. We have a rare diseases advisory panel. But I think you do well to point out the fact that we have not succeeded in funding a lot yet, and it needs ongoing attention.
Good morning. I'm going to ask about payers and payer engagement in PCORI, which was at the very outset problematic.
Well, it's not problematic anymore, I'd say. We have very good working relationship with, particularly with the insurers through AHIP, through America's Health Insurance Plans, which is the national organization representing all the major insurers, and they work with us on PCORnet, and in fact, we have a meeting with them today to talk about additional ways they can work with us on PCORnet. And they're very interested in what they call rapid cycle research. So if we can find ways to join providers and health plans in conducting research that's of interest to both, I think that's a real step in the right direction. Payers will be represented, I think, really across the spectrum of payers in our hepatitis C meeting, for example. So I think they're, Charlotte, I think they're beginning to see both that and believe that PCORI could be a useful venue for them to go to. I think payers see some of the CER questions more distinctly than just about anyone else because they're being asked to pay for things they haven't been asked to pay for before. And when that comes up, they do look for evidence. And there isn't any doubt that right now they are happy to say, no evidence. There's no evidence that this is any better. Therefore, it costs three times as much. We're not inclined to pay for it. We need evidence. But I do think that good evidence, particularly evidence perhaps that helps you get at who are the patients that benefit, is just what they need. And I really don't think payers are any different than anybody else, that they have responsibility for a certain amount of available funds. But I think, knowing that something actually is better from the patient's point of view in a particular group of patients, it will be embraced by them as well. Yes, a couple more. Paul and then I think Sarah probably.
You referenced the hepatitis C roundtable, but I would just encourage that I think in the context of all of these larger pragmatic trials in particular, since they're these are very defined topics, I think that kind of convening is something that not only should it be a one-off kind of convening, but it should be a convening that happens consistently. So maybe that's an advisory panel related to each one of those trials that continues to convene throughout the research process, just to make sure that you're hitting the right topics, the right research design, and that throughout the process, too, that you're creating some anticipation for the research results so that they'll be easier to disseminate.
Thanks. Well, that's definitely the idea. I mean, that's we've come to appreciate that an awful lot of engagement is about, number one, getting the questions right, and number two, creating the anticipation for the results. And number three, when the results are there, you know, a readiness to do something with them. I should have said, Sarah and Charlotte, that the list of high-priority questions that is on that comes with our funding announcement about pragmatic clinical studies, that list was contributed to not entirely, trust me, but a number of the items on that list were, in fact, research questions submitted by payers and purchasers, so health insurers and large employers who self-insure. So that's another connection we have with them. And I take your point, Sarah, that one way or the other, payers ought to, even if they're not maybe right in on, with the research team on every project, and we actually hope sometimes they are, but they ought to be brought in as the projects are developing and results are beginning to come out again, as a way to facilitate dissemination, but actually implementation, which in this case would sometimes mean a decision to cover.
Right, but I think what I'm also saying is that the larger advisory panels that include the patient groups and the physicians, and I mean that those convenings, whatever you're doing that's informing the topic, that those panels
yes.
or those advisory groups should stay, you know, not just the payers. I'm sure that I know the payers are part of that discussion, but the group as a whole, to create an advisory panel around these specific topics so that you have real experts at the table from both the patient and clinician perspectives as well. But that they're with the project throughout the life of the project.
Paul?
I appreciate your comments to answer our questions. I've been thinking a lot about the review process, and I want to compliment you on how far we've come in such a short amount of time. I'm particularly interested in the scientific reviewers and their qualifications. I'm curious how we're confident that these individuals are capable or qualified to be that scientific portion to ensure the rigor we expect. For example, I think you and I would probably both agree that the degree of MD alone is probably not sufficient to be a scientific reviewer. So I'm curious what safeguards we have, particularly with the scientific. I don't think it's as vital, you know, for the clinician reviewer and for the patient reviewer because they don't always have to answer those scientific questions.
Yeah, I don't know that we have anybody in the room who actually is from the merit review process, but I can tell you that they have extremely large banks of potential reviewers, and these reviewers apply to be reviewers, and they get reviewed to make sure of their credentials. Most of them have done reviews before, for example, so this is not their first time. But I will tell you also that one of the things we learned from the broad announcements that have generated most of our science to date, most of our funded projects to date, is that it is extremely difficult to find, I mean, it just doesn't work that way, to find scientists who can just sort of pick up a project on cystic fibrosis and then move to a project on heart failure and then move to a project on substance abuse. That's few people, or you can't get the depth of appreciation of the exact questions that way. So one of the nice things about the pragmatic clinical studies review is that it's a much smaller group of topics, and we can make certain that for every study, we've got people whose research experience is in that area. So I think that it's a very fair question to ask about our review process when NIH that isn't like that. Every institute is focused on a subset of conditions, and so they can bring a group of scientists who they know and who are specialized in that area. It's tougher. I used to be on the study section with ARC, and it could be fairly tough with ARC as well, because they at least, the one I was on was quality and effectiveness research. And, it didn't have it really had projects across the whole. It had projects across improving systems and individual diseases and addressing disparities too. So it was probably about as broad as ours are. But it's tough. Darius.
So my sense is that folks are getting the value, the importance of engagement as they're applying for the CORI funding, which is great. I also get the sense that there's some challenges on the back end. So you complete the trial, you have findings, you are now interested in disseminating, and some of the dissemination might be within the project period, but some of it might be after the project period. And so if a applicant doesn't have funds to support some of the patient and stakeholders after the project period ends, that could be a challenge to continuing to have that stakeholder involvement with dissemination. So I'm wondering if you have thoughts on ways that we can make sure that the engagement doesn't end at the end of the project period and it actually continues with the dissemination that might end 1 year, 2 years, however many years after the project.
That's a good question. And Gene could probably could add to whatever I say on this topic, but I'll say a couple things. First of all, one of the early steps in dissemination is just getting news about the findings out. And so, and this may have gotten mentioned yesterday, but this is important for you to look at. Right now on our website is a proposed policy for how we are going to both peer review research findings and how we're going to post them for public consumption, both an early posting of a results table and an abstract, and then a somewhat later publishing of the entire final report from the project. So that's one thing. We had a press conference a couple days ago, and there were some good comments from the audience about ways to make that more patient-centered. It really is, the whole thought is getting these results in front of and available to patients, caregivers, and clinicians. We would greatly appreciate your going and taking a look at this and submitting a comment. You can also see the comments that hundreds of other people have submitted. The second is that in the legislation, ARC is charged with this dissemination. And so if you read it, or it might be fairer to say that both ARC and PCORI are told to disseminate, but when you read it, it sounds like the money for dissemination is sent to ARC. So our board has been paying attention to that from day one. ARC is paying particular attention to it now. We are talking with ARC about setting up clear handoffs, not that we'd walk away, but clear handoffs when we have findings that deserve dissemination. And I think Gail's here. I think the board continues to ask itself whether there are or whether there aren't other ways to do dissemination over and above what ARC does that we should put some of our funds to when the time comes. So we're watching it very carefully. There's also a dissemination and implementation plan that's being developed and will be out. I think we have a meeting in early December on that. So, Gene, you might want to add to that.
Darius, that's a really good question. I'm interpreting your question to mean, if you have established a relationship, like you're doing a study in a health plan, how can you, after the study ends, make sure that health plan is aware of those results and take them up? So it's not actually part of the research anymore, but it's part of the implementation. So, we do have what are called Eugene Washington Engagement Awards, which would really support would be a program support to that kind of activity. So, a study that takes place in a health plan, and now you want the health plan policymakers and participants in the health plan to be aware of the results and to take them up. That would be, a perfect proposal to submit to the Eugene Washington Engagement Awards, because that's a small-scale, short-term implementation in a local environment. And then that taking it to scale was something that
we are working on in collaboration with AHRQ.
And the other thing, Gene's attention to what your question actually was reminded me that my interpretation of what your question actually was really about if all the funding goes away, how are they going to be involved in? So a couple of things. One thing, the methodology committee warned us early on that sometimes it's not the researchers who do the study that are the best disseminators. So we didn't build dissemination funds into the individual project. Also, we didn't know if a project would merit dissemination. But the second thing I think is, what I meant to say is, between ourselves and ARC, I think we will not fail to remember that those organizations and individuals who were with us from the beginning are among the best disseminators. So we will have to find, a way to keep them involved. All right. And then Steve.
Yeah, I think it's great you're doing the peer review, and I think that a lot of what PCORI's done has been so successful on the patient engagement side has been things like adopting the rubric and then having the rubric be an incentive for a grant and then having it be a measuring tool. I mean, I just think you guys are doing a fabulous job of implementing cultural change. I think it's hard to do. What I'm wondering is on peer review, have you given any thought to patient peer review?
Yes. Well, I'll be honest with you. We didn't give as much thought as we should have before we put the draft policy up, but it's coming at us fast and furious, including it was about the first comment made at our press conference the other day. So, as expert as we are on patient engagement, that one slipped by us almost.
Well, it's interesting because obviously it has dissemination ramifications, but, BMJ just recently turn to an open peer review system, so you know who you're reviewing, they know who's reviewing them, and they publish everything. So you get to read the full train of how this article evolved into where its final resting place is in terms of publication. I think it's a really enlightening tool for getting people to see different perspectives.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Thanks, Lorraine. Steve.
So one of the things I've always appreciated, PCORI coming to us and asking us to provide, input and feedback on the different programs and platforms that you're developing, which has been great. In many ways, that's a very reactive way of working for us. And I think there's a ton of creativity and energy in the room, and a lot of that is born from the different perspectives that we bring. So what I'd like to ask is as you're thinking into the future and some of the problems and challenges that you guys are trying to work through, are there some ways that we can work more proactively to try to help you come up with ideas and direction that you can go and tap into some of that creativity that we have?
That's an interesting question. I guess I would have, if somebody outside this group had asked me, I would have said, well, that's, we get a lot of that from the PEEP. So if you're saying we're just asking you to react, then I'll take that up with Sue after the meeting. But I mean, I'm sure she heard it as well as I did it.
Yeah, I would just say, what are kind of some of the key issues, some of the key challenges and problems that, you guys want to work through over the course of the next year or two? And maybe we can become part of that dialogue to help develop the programs, to develop the platforms, and get in on the ground floor and building those things, as opposed to, reacting to what's been kind of developed independently.
Okay. Well, I have two things to say to that, and I would suggest you guys maybe want to come back to this before the day is out if you get a chance. The one is, we say it a lot, but it's still true that we haven't done nearly enough yet to actually prove that engagement makes a difference. We all know it in our hearts. It's common sense. I think even if you did the research and you didn't find a difference, most of us would figure that there was just something wrong with the way we did the research, that it is does make a difference. But we need to figure out ways. If we want to convince people that the extra resources we put into it and the extra time that it takes is worth not only continuing at PCORI but spreading to other entities, we ought to prove it better than we have to date. And so you've helped us. The rubric itself is very helpful as a measuring tool, as you said. So as Lorene said. So that's one. And the other is we actually do have to convince people that that PCORI is doing important research, both the research on very obviously patient-centered themes and the research now on patient-centered questions within larger disease entities. Other thoughts you have on how we spread the word about PCORI? We obviously in 2018, Congress will either take up or fail to take up the question of whether the way that PCORI does research should continue. So that's something we're all beginning to think more about now than we had up
to this
point.
And I think I'm thinking less of kind of those bigger questions, more so kind of, the smaller kind of nuts and bolts from, more of the implementation. I'm thinking things like the compensation policy, the thinking around, the use of terminology, patient, subject. So the smaller kind of little granular things, those are the things I'm thinking of in terms of, because I think, showing engagement makes a difference, convincing people this is important work. I think a lot of that's going to be reflected, through the evaluation process. And, we've obviously provided some input and direction to that. I'm really thinking about, kind of the little nuts and bolts that keep the gears going. What are some of the ways that we can provide some input from a stakeholder perspective on some of those things?
Okay, good. Thanks. Bruce, and then Amy, and then Perry, and then I should, yeah.
In cleaning up the PCORI map of awards, and just looking at it, being from the Midwest, what I'm seeing is a lack of much going on in the central part of the United States and extremely heavy on the East Coast. And we got about 5 states that have nothing going on. How can we or, perhaps ambassadors help encourage more involvement out in these areas and get it scattered out more across the United States?
Mm-hmm.
Or what are we not doing that we should be doing?
Yeah. We have been watching that map from day one, and it is gradually filling in. I think we knocked off Kansas not long ago, and we just knocked off Oklahoma when I say knock off, I mean we've got one award there, one or maybe two, I'm not sure, but
Idaho's got anything.
What? Idaho, yes.
That's
a conflict of interest. If we sent money to Idaho, people would just say, well, Sue Sheridan is from there, no wonder so. Move around a little bit. We have asked ourselves that, and some of our regional conferences have been in states like Kansas and Minnesota as well. And we actually did talk at one point about having a regional workshop right in Boise, but we haven't gotten there yet. But I think it's a great question. We've looked at, like, what's the issue, what's the lesion here? Is it that nobody's applying from those states, or is it that people are applying and not doing well in the review? And it definitely looks much more like it's a failure to apply. So it's more about getting the word out that PCORI is funding.
All right, specific one, because I deal a lot with Rochester. Is Rochester one, there's one dot on Minnesota.
There's only one dot?
Yeah.
I don't have the map you're looking at.
In the southeast corner. So I don't know if that's Rochester or not, but, the medical complex you have there.
Yeah, and it's a very patient-centered complex, too.
Chest pain choice trial, it says. Doesn't say.
Yeah, Victor has not applied for money.
Doesn't say where.
Yeah. Well, we'll look at that. I would have guessed Minnesota was doing all right. Amy?
So I have a question about engagement, but engagement with our legislators. So being involved in the autism world for a long time and having a lot of a lot of the legislation now really driven by families pushing hard and getting to know our legislators. Is there a plan for, I mean, I know 2019 sounds a long way off, but for it before we know it, it's around the corner, and to use some of the engagement efforts to really get out there and talk to our congressmen and congresswomen about, you know, all the good that PCORI has done?
We are talking about that a lot, and what strategies we feel comfortable using, what strategies we feel start to sound like lobbying, and we actually have a consultant who helps us understand what makes sense to do and what doesn't. But I think part of that strategy over the next year or two will be talking more frankly to organizations about that. Thank you for asking the question. And you aren't the first, so it's nice to say is you're not alone. Others have thought of that too. Thank you. And Perry.
I'm interested in the concept of patient activation as distinguished from patient engagement. And activation is... Activation involves healing and group support and things like that, whereas engagement is also involved with contacting and communicating with patients. But the activation is more of the part of the healing process. So my question would be, is PCORI emphasizing that at all?
Well, that's an interesting way to look at things. I agree that engagement is not as intense as activation, right? That's part of what you're saying, that activation is like first you get engaged, but then you get activated.
Well, you get activated in order to take charge of your own health.
Exactly. And that's a topic that's talked about most often in the world of clinical care as opposed to the world of research, but it would be interesting to think about what patient activation in research actually means, and we might not be there yet, so that would be interesting to ask whether there's a next stage beyond engagement.
Yeah, I do want to, one of the things that we probably haven't discussed in the piece is that we do have a pretty large group of research awards that are around peer navigators
self-care.
So we are doing research projects. I think there are about 30 of them that deal with some aspects of activation through peer navigation, self-care, adherence, and
mm-hmm. Thanks.
And Perry, something I think that, Joe, you just brought up in interpreting what Perry said was activated patients in research. And actually, we have had some PIs of PCORI-funded projects share with us that they've been surveying their patient partners, and they're finding that it is healing for the patient partners. Some examples came in from the mental health areas that we have funded that the patients are actually benefiting from being patient partners. Just that activity has given them confidence, has given them hope. And actually we had a PI ask us if she could develop kind of this throughout everything that we're funding. And so we are hearing from the PIs that this is actually a very healing, and they're hearing it directly from their patient partners. So we're kind of creating this new activated patient partner in research. And I think you bring up a good point.
Thank you, Sue, for articulating what I was trying to say.
There's one more card up, and she hasn't spoken yet today, so. Okay. Sally.
Thank you. Thank you, Joe, for being here to answer questions. A couple of things. Actually, Amy took my initial point, but I'll reinforce it. Was wondering about what, as a panel, we could be doing to prepare for the 2018 And also, following up on Steve's comment, being proactive about that. So not necessarily reactive. You know, like if you're starting to come up with ways of being able to do something about it that we could influence or have a part of without it suggesting lobbying in any way, but also starting to, you know, promote the notion that this is a direction we need to be going in. And then I think just following up on Perry's comment, because I think it's really an important one, one of the things I hear frequently when we're around the table is that this is about patient engagement in research. And what I'd really like us to start thinking about is that, you know, research is one thing, but research should be happening at the point of care in every encounter. It should, every clinical encounter should just be an opportunity to learn something. So I think I would like us to start thinking about that and sort of start distinguishing somewhat, I think, between the two, between delivery and research, and really start to engage with the notion that every opportunity to engage with a patient, whether you're in delivery or you're across the table in a focus group or you're, you know, giving them a questionnaire, is an opportunity to learn. And that in and of itself should contribute to research. So I'm just trying to, I've heard this a lot in the last 2 days, that it's about engagement and research. And I really am starting to think that distinguishing those two things from the actual point of care, I think it's a disservice, and I think we need to be focusing more on the continuous thing. Learning health system occurs at any point in time. We can learn something each step of the way. So just a point.
Well, that's a good point. That really does speak to PCORnet and the patient council on PCORnet, and as you all know, Lorraine sits on the executive committee of PCORnet. So that is clearly something that has to change in this country if there is going to be such thing as a learning health system, is that clinical care is research.
I think we can lead the way in that. I think we can lead the way simply with vocabulary, how we talk about it. So that would be my suggestion.
Thanks.
Well, and just to follow up very quickly on that, I mean, you may have noticed that CMMI recently was requesting comments on how to engage beneficiaries in the context of all the work that they're doing. So, I mean, I do think Sally's absolutely right. I mean, there's a lot of the work that I think Corey's doing that translates, and that it should all be talked about in the same context.
Well, and just to let you know, CMMI called us asking for referrals to patient partners. So that kind of sparked our fertilization discussion yesterday. It's like, how do we have a larger conversation about patient engagement? Because it's really a patient-engaged, patient-centered healthcare system that we're a part of, that it's all a continuum. Regina, are you on the phone?
Morning.
Do you have a question?
Yes, I do. Yes, I do. Good morning, everybody. Good morning, Jill. Thank you for joining us. And I want to say that I've been with PCORI volunteering since July of 2012, and I'm still excited. And I get excited more every day when I do activities, engage with communities and researchers, and even working virtually with you here. Jill, I've got a couple of comments about the ambassador program, and specifically in some of the experience that I'm having, which I think is I'm really using the ambassador program to really, and I'll use Perry's term, activate community so they get involved in research, not only to become a part of research, but to really help design some of the studies and really ask them the questions to feed into researchers. One of the concerns that I have, you know, after listening to the really great work that Ange and Sue and the team there is doing with the ambassador program, I'm still concerned about the minority participation, and I know we all are. And I'm looking to see if there's anything that maybe the board can do to really help us and really put it more at the top. Because the ambassadors are really the boots on the ground as far as really getting the PCORI name and the work that we're doing into the field. You know, I see the ambassadors really working and sharing that rubric that can really get patients and communities excited about our research, and really using a rubric too as a tool to really connect the patient community and the researchers to sit at the table and talk about it. So I wanted to see if there's anything that you might suggest, or we could ask you, or I could ask you to really us work with the board more to get the ambassador program out and rolling and get the minority and underserved communities up. Pastor and I talk about this quite often, you know, when we're in our daily lives, you know, what can we do to get that going? And also another concern is, and I think Steve made a good comment about, and I picked up what he said, that it's the patients that really make PCORI have the research done differently model. And the differently is actually the patient involvement. So I think the ambassador program is really the important in really getting that research done differently into the communities. And then finally, I'm a member of the patient clinician advisory council on our CDRN here in Chicago Capricorn. We had our meeting Tuesday, and I will tell you, we are working very hard, very much like, if not more harder, I think, than when some of the panel work we do there in D.C. You know, I'm very impressed with it, with the progression that we've made. We've got our own governance structure going on now. So I'm looking forward more to working with them. And that's actually the ambassador programs and the CDRNs and PPRNs are actually what we're actually bringing PCORI into the communities and the cities around the country.
Well, that was provocative question, and I think that I really can't say, Regina, that I have a lot of thoughts right at this moment, but I think it's appreciate your pointing it out, and I do think it's something that that this group could take under consideration, and we can at PCORI as well. So a lot of organizations that we do interact with who I think might be able to point us toward patients and local organizations and communities that we could get develop closer relationships with. Okay, well, I'm going to thank you all for your time, and it's great to see you, and we so much appreciate your work and your guidance. So carry on. Thank you, Sue.
Thank you, Joe. Charlotte is going to direct. Kristen, do you have a quick comment? Sure. While Joe leaves, or do you want Joe to hear this? Do we have to? Okay.
The thing I was just going to respond to quickly, and I know I've talked about this earlier, so I promise I won't be long. I haven't sent it out to everybody because I don't know sort of the norms around doing this. But on this conversation of a broader view of engagement and the role of research engagement, patient engagement, obviously activation is a psychological state. It's a locus of control. It's a sense of control. Can I do it, right? Engagement is a broader concept other than just a psychological state. So remember I came and I talked to you about the convening. Well, we have published and put out our roadmap for patient and family engagement in healthcare and research. And I think I just want to encourage you all to take a look at this, because I think it provides, and Sue participated, PCORI participated, as did a number of other funders and a variety of stakeholders, with really taking this big picture of what's the broad view, what's the broad roadmap towards the kind of engagement we want. Research and engagement in research is a big part of this, but it's one part of a bigger picture. And I think you might find this a helpful way to sort of be thinking about what are the different pathways and opportunities for engagement, both in research and practice. Okay.
Thanks. We're now going to transition to the next item on our agenda, which I'm going to give a little bit of background on, because we have several new members as a part of our group, and there may be others on the phone who are not familiar with why we do this. Can we advance the slide? Although it's just a title slide, so I'll go ahead and get to this. Several meetings ago, we talked about compensation as a large group, and we convened a subcommittee to try to reduce some of our thoughts and our comments and to do some research into this topic and come back to the full group, which we did at our last meeting. And at the last meeting, the subcommittee came up with a framework, suggested guidance that we circulated in advance. We had some discussion and feedback from many of you at the table, and in the intervening period, the subcommittee has gotten together a couple of times by conference call and come up with some changes that hopefully reflect the thoughts that you shared with us at our meeting last spring. So that was circulated to everyone, and hopefully we can have a discussion today based on that guidance. I don't have any, didn't prepare any PowerPoint slides, but thank you. Rachel is recirculating a printed copy. I could take one, too, of the two-page document that we came up with. And the subcommittee had participation, but not just by me and Lorraine, but also Regina and Sue and the rest of the staff. I'm assuming we're also involved in helping out on this. So it should be in front of you by now, and let me just say that what we tried to do is to, first of all, clarify the point that was made about compensation, as that this framework is really primarily aimed at giving the research team some direction about engaging, compensating patients, caregivers, and patient organizations for their engagement in TCOR, but not to give any really specific guidance about those who participate as research subjects. And we had some discussion about that terminology at our full meeting, and hopefully we've tried to accomplish that by coming up in the initial page of the document with a terminology sheet that explains that human research participants, you know, who they are, and that this really would suggest that they be, you know, that their expenses be covered simply, but that when we talk about compensation, we're really talking about the engaged research partners, which we've also attempted to define. The second thing is that we wanted to make it clear that this was not a rate sheet. You know, in other words, we aren't saying that, you know, PCORI says that you must have a compensation package in place for engaged research partners that includes a mandatory set or a minimum or so forth, and it doesn't even really suggest a range. But what it suggests is that the research team ought to at least consult with all the stakeholders, all the participants, before coming up with a plan for compensation, and that the principle is that the compensation should be fair based on the circumstances, including the level of engagement that's expected and the particular circumstances of the patients, caregivers, and patient organizations that are involved. So with that introduction, I would open it up for questions and then discussion. So any just basically questions first, and then we can go around for comments.
So mine was actually a comment, but followed by a question. Being the new person in the group, in reading this over, I really liked the patient-centered variations that you've included, giving the patient partner the opportunity to opt out or to donate it. I'm wondering, and I think that starts to address and I don't want to call it an issue, but sometimes I find that families or patients feel funny taking a stipend, feel like they need to donate it because they're doing it for the greater good, they're doing it to help out, but to really highlight the importance of it, that they are an equal partner. So I think that I love this addition. I don't know if it was an addition, but I really like this paragraph and was wondering if there was any way to include another sentence or two about the importance of why we're doing it, that, you know, you may not feel comfortable taking it, but, you know, here are other options, and here's why it's important to take it.
you have a suggestion about what that should say?
Not exactly, but I can work on it. you know, just a statement to say, you know, I've been in me, and it could, maybe it's just me and I'm one voice, and please, please chime in. But I, you know, hear sometimes from patient partners, because this is such a new concept, and even with family advisory councils, we're looking at the same things. So we're also, you know, we're also going back and forth about this. But, you know, a lot of inclination is, you know, you have a disease and somebody's asked you to help with a project on finding a cure for that disease or something. Some people feel like they need to donate their time. So, and I'm not sure, and I would be happy to think more about, you know, the way to address it, but I do think that I understand it needs to be a guidance, but I think more patient and family partners need to understand the importance of it.
I just want to underscore Amy's point, and we at the pilot Project Learning Network, we had sort of I don't think the focus was supposed to be compensation, but that's where we landed for the bulk of the conversation, and this issue came up, and there was actually sort of almost a split in the room. Half of the people said, well, but I do this because it makes me feel good, it's the right thing to do, and we also totally understand that. I've been a volunteer as well, but then other people said, well, but there's this, it's the message that you're sending, and if you've got a team and panels and you've got everyone on the team minus the patients receiving compensation, what are you communicating about the relative value of the participation? And so we sort of struck this balance of, well, how about if you you receive compensation as a matter of course, but if you just don't feel right about actually taking the money, that's where this option to donate or do something with it comes up. So I think maybe that piece, it's really just yet another way that we enforce the notion of parity, of equity on the team. There's also the element of there may be people who would like to participate, but it actually is a barrier to have to miss work or, you know, any of the costs that come up attendant to being involved in something like this, transportation, childcare, et cetera. So I think there's also it's a great pathway for those folks who may not otherwise be able to participate. So I just wanted to echo your thoughts, Amy. I think, and I will say, we get this question from funded projects. I just had one last week where there's actually a live conversation happening among the members of the team. Some of the patients are saying, I'm fine to just volunteer. I don't need compensation. And so it's really, this is going to continue to surface as a really kind of complicated issue.
Lorraine. And then I'm just going to go around. And in fact, let's just go around with questions and comments too. So thank you.
I think this is a really important point that's been raised. And I guess my concern is that we may end up creating some peer review for people, for peer pressure for people to not accept compensation. And then that would mean that we would have a disparity among those who could economically afford to participate as a partner and those who could not. So that's one concern that I have. I think, you know, there is the issue of sustainability of patient engagement. And it is true, I believe, that you find that you have less robust engagement if you are not compensating, that you end up with those who have the ability and the means to the exclusion of others. So I would be very careful about that just because I think it can create some unanticipated consequences, and it's not clear to me who you donate the money to. Do you donate back to your other research partners, and now you're really saying, no, you're worth more than me? Seriously, you're worth more than me. I mean, I'm just...
All
I wonder if we could talk just for a minute about the term expertise. Just that I'm a little concerned that it could be misleading. I can tell you, and I feel like I'm hung up on reviews today, but oftentimes in a review panel, when we're looking at an advisory panel, and we see a physician that sits on the advisory panel, and they're going to pay them $75 an hour versus the patient, and they're going to pay them $25 an hour. That's an issue to a lot of patient reviewers, clinical reviewers. But it seems like it could be justified if I read this and said, well, compensation should reflect the level of expertise. Well, a physician, you know, their time arguably, you could argue, is worth more than the patient's time is. But I just want to make sure we don't mislead with the term expertise, or because I'm afraid applicants would then say, well, it's because the physician has expertise, that's why there's not this equipoise that maybe we are really expecting to see in the application.
Can I just say this? I recall that this came up during the discussion at either one of our subcommittee meetings or at the first meeting, that we wanted to, at the last meeting of the full group, that we wanted to make sure that, you know, simply having a certain licensure or certification didn't trip a higher level of compensation standing alone, and that we challenged the team to look at other things other than just having an MD, you know, including, and I think we used the word levels of expertise, but we also used other descriptors, and now I'm trying to find out where we are in the document, which I thought was shorter, but maybe it's not. Yeah, principles of equity, at the last paragraph on page one, it says fair compensation should include their role in the research project, skills and capabilities, and considerations of principles of equity and fairness, level of skill, expertise and experience, time commitment, comparable levels of pay and responsibility. So it's, I think what we were trying to show with that long sentence is that it's not just, you know, the degree, but that they should take in all of these things into account. But you're saying let's just delete the word expertise.
I worry about the word expertise.
Okay.
I do like the levels. I like the levels a lot, you know, the ones that are very highly involved, you know, and okay, breaking it down that way, because that makes more sense to me.
I mean, I'm not the decider, but I'm just making I'll make that point when we recirculate. Yeah. Okay.
Charlotte,
I'm sorry. Oh, go ahead, Lauren.
No, just one last thing. Thinking about that, Paul, it just seems like we could have used the words contributions to the effort, because, you know, a lot of times patient organizations bring participants. They bring research subjects. They bring awareness. They bring dissemination. And those are all valuable things that we didn't manage to capture. I know we tried to catch them all, but...
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's interesting because you could imagine a sentence reading something like considerations include principles of equity and fairness, level of skill, experience, and instead of time commitment, more of the contribution to the effort, because I think expertise and level of skill are kind of, I wouldn't call them redundant, but they're relatively replaceable. And
yeah,
instead of time, it could be the contribution to the effort. I just offer that up as a concrete suggestion. I just wanted to say, I think it's fabulous, because this is really hard to do, and I think you did a fantastic job with distinguishing, you know, your role as participants versus engaged research partners. You're clearly on a teeter-totter here. You're sitting. That equipoise is a great way, I think, just to describe this document, right? It's trying to encourage people to do the right thing, bring a framework to it that creates a sense of equity for folks. I think it's hard not to put some of this detail in. And I think some of this is just going to have to work its way out in the world. Like at some point, you've got to put it out there and request. I do like the idea, though, of thinking about language that makes it clear that something about, you know, the importance and the value of valuing your time and accepting it. You'll never get away from some people saying, not worth my time, I don't want to take the money, for sure. But I think some legitimizing of that, I think, will be a value. The one danger you just raised for me, though, is hadn't thought about it so much. And this is just like setting norms. Like, you can't regulate this, but you can imagine folks saying, well, I'm going to go with the folks who are going to say, no, I don't need the money. But then that means PCORI and others have to judge people on the diversity and the socioeconomic and cultural diversity of participation. Like, there's ways of getting at that because you can't sort of force people into that. So I think it's a really true comment, but I would sort of do that on the outcomes, you know, sort of saying we're going to judge you on the kind of participation that you have. But I think on balance, just great, and I love the levels of participation. The only last thing I would say is, since PCORI has been so terrific about saying we're trying to move people from more informed to really collaboration and stakeholder-directed, that there also should be a statement in this that an ideal state is moving towards more collaboration. Pretty great.
Okay. I'm not sure I understand that.
So that piece is just some note that, remember, what we've talked about over and over again is saying that these are not equal states. In fact, PCORI takes a stand, and this PEEP has taken a stand repeatedly, that we're moving people towards more collaboration. That's all.
What you're suggesting is just putting in a statement at the kind of at the top of the table that says, ideally, the team is moving toward more collaboration.
I think the movement towards equipoise here and the concept of fair compensation is really needed. I think there's a little bit of a discrepancy in that last paragraph on page one where it's going to talk about fair compensation, but then when we go down towards the bottom, it's sort of lost, and there's discussion about compensation at the same level as professionals on the team, although I think the way out of that is that there's wording may be compensated helps us there. The issue is maybe around fair market value, and maybe we need some external kind of legal input into this, because I know some organizations may not be able to respond to this even if they want to do that, because there'll be perceptions of, well, if people have different levels of expertise, what's fair market value-based compensation for them, which could get us into a little bit of trouble. For example, if say industry wants to follow this, and there's a representative from a patient advocacy organization, if industry would compensate at the same level regardless of level of expertise, it could look like inducement or some kind of influence peddling or coercion in a non-research sense, but some form of coercion towards that, of course it's not the right word, it's influence of that patient advocacy organization beyond what a fair market value-based compensation would be. So I think it's just some wordsmithing, but I mean, I think generally it's really headed in the right direction for sure.
Steve, and then Regina, we're going to go to you, and then Laurel.
I just wanted to make the point about compensation versus out-of-pocket costs and expenses. So I do see on the terminology for human research participants, a statement that expenses may vary based on the needs and exceptional circumstances. And I really think we need to have something like that incorporated, because I don't see, for folks that are acting in advisory capacity, expenses for opportunity costs and other circumstances that may be unique to the individual that will allow them to participate.
Can you point to some language?
Well, I think the language that you have in the terminology is great. I just think we need to add in the bottom section when we're talking about compensation, that compensation should also include reimbursement for reasonable out-of-pocket expenses, and that these may vary based on the needs and circumstances of the individual. You know, one example is, say you have someone that's a caregiver, right, and you're asking them to participate in a meeting or conference, and, you know, they need to find an alternative source of care for whoever it is that they're caring for.
So that's an opportunity cost, and it's an expense for them. So for them to be able to participate, it should be reasonable to reimburse them for that additional care. And I think, you know, that should be included in something like this. So it's not just the stipends, you know, it's also making sure that there's equity in allowing the participation.
Charlotte, can I offer one quick comment on this? It's such a critical issue, but this is actually something that is an ongoing conversation among our science colleagues, and actually we've got some elements to the legislation and sort of our policies and procedures about what is allowable and what's not, and so I will commit to getting the language of the policy once it's final and sharing that with you, because it does, there's sort of this fine line between what we have purview over and then what's sort of dictated by legislation, et cetera. So let me circle back to the PEEP on this notion of reimbursement for cost, because it's critical, but I don't want to steer you into thinking that we might actually have control over that part. So if we want to focus more on the partner element, that might be more where we're situated.
Are you suggesting that any detailed reference to reimbursement is going to be of necessity deferred to a different policy?
In terms of the subjects in the research itself, let me get sort of the letter of the policy to you so that it can be a little more clear right now. Like I said, these conversations are happening right now, so I just need to get that to you. So we might want to focus attention more on the partner end of the spectrum.
Okay. All right. Let me get Regina in if she wants to get in, and then we'll go back around.
Okay. Thank you. You know, I really appreciate hearing everyone's comments and concerns. This is really good good conversation, and the compensation program, which I really, really take to heart because we work it in. I work it in with the thoughts of it. When I provide the rubric to communities that I work with, and I look at it from the stance of equity. No one's going to get rich in this equity this compensation program. And I think it's very, I don't think we should look at it really on the stance of, dollars or anything. It's a recognition of the value people's knowledge, especially research partners in the community, bring to the table when we begin to design this research. Now, I even think about caregivers. Now, they said the average caregiver hours are like 34.9 hours per week, and if you would never be able to compensate anybody for that amount of time. But the compensation is really a recognition of their equity as research partners, specifically their roles, and that you value it. And I've talked to folks, you know, here in the community about it, and they care more about them being recognized as equal partners and being provided some type of compensation for value of their time, just of recognition, versus the dollar amount. So I want to say that this is such an important program or part of of our engagement piece. So just want to make those few comments there.
Thank you. And I see Lorraine's card up. And did I miss Chris? Are you? You're done? Okay. Bruce and Esther and Laurel. Sorry. So, but we need to keep this short, pithy comments related to this specific document, because we are about to run out of time.
Okay, quick as a cricket. I just wanted to go back to the point that was made by Stephen earlier regarding market value, and point out that a lot of what we're doing here has no market value because we're creating the market. So that's one thing I want to point out. And the other point I wanted to make about compensation is this really falls a lot more in the partnership model, which is where you value everything everybody puts into the pie, and then you value everything people take out of the pie. It's just a different way of putting together a deal.
Uh,
I started with Steve's comments about compensation. And one of the things I find in rural areas in working, I have to come to it from the context of as a parish pastor. But if I'm doing pastoral counseling, if I don't charge for that service, they don't commit. And so that becomes a problem with volunteers. You ask for it. If there's not some kind of a commitment on their part, they're not going to be involved. They also, at least where I'm at, are inhibited by certifications and titles and tend to be less outspoken. And I find that myself. First time I showed up in this group, I was just and asking why in the world I was sitting here, you know, compared to what some of you have for degrees and, you know, the work and expertise that you have. The other thing that comes up is, in order for me to come, at least, I have to pay for someone to watch my wife. So it's cost me $20 an hour per day for every day I'm here. And I do that because I want to be a part of the Cora and to work because, number one, it gets me out of Iowa, and I need to get out of Iowa every so often. Number two, networking and working with you folks is the best thing I've had to me in many years. So, you know, for me, part of it is I can say I'm a part of the Cora, and when I talk to doctors, my wife says, now I've got 15 doctors that know they're going to talk about the quarry when I show up at Rochester and in La Crosse and locally. Because this is part of what I'm doing and what I see is my task. So I'm not looking for compensation necessarily, yet that does help with some of my expense. Those things come out of this. The other thing is in regards to the research participants, sometimes in some of the research my wife has been part of, Madison, the compensation was turned not in money, but in care. That the facility offered additional medical care and compensation being a part of a study. And I don't see that here as something that's possible unless we decide it.
Gina, are you there?
She's there.
She's there.
Your question, or do I get to make more comments? Wow.
Regina, sorry, dear. Can you?
I can't hear.
Regina, this is Sue. Yeah. Regina, dear, can you please turn yourself on mute? I think we're getting some feedback, sweetie.
Okay, hold on. Let me see. Can you hear me? How's this? Okay.
Let me try this. You need to mute yourself while you're not talking. So if you just go on mute while you're not speaking, it will help a lot.
All right. Thank you. Sorry.
Okay, I have some questions. Are the compensation levels determined on a study-by-study activity basis?
I think so. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, I think the sense that we got was that we didn't want to set up an enterprise-wide, PCORI-wide expectation of what compensation levels should be and that the group making the proposal ought to come together and ask themselves these questions and come to some conclusions collaboratively. Yes.
Last year I was privileged to be a part of some of the grant reviews, and what I found was in those grant reviews it was on the basis of each grant what they decided they were going to reimburse or give. There was no uniformity to it at all.
And my second question was that there are existing models for this type of compensation, like the DOD where I'm a consumer reviewer, but I'm paid the same compensation as a scientist and the other people on that review committee, and we probably put in about the same amount of time.
I just wanted to make a quick comment related to this point, and this is maybe a question for the PCORI folks. As this moves forward, I wonder how much the contracts folks at PCORI need to be involved in this, because I can imagine a scenario where an applicant would propose X amount of dollars for certain stakeholders, and the contract folks might say, what is this for? What's the justification? Why are they getting so much? And I don't know whether, you know, the contract folks look at it with that level of detail, but I'm just thinking that that's an important audience who needs to understand this framework as well moving forward.
Contracts has been involved in a few meetings that we've had so far, just in terms of it, more so for other events outside of compensated patient partners in research, because this framework will also help us, like, for example, when we do small working groups or roundtables where we're compensating. So this is really a framework not only for the conduct of research, but it's going to help our contracts people and our finance people understand what PCORI is all about. Now, our contracts people, to my knowledge, don't necessarily get that engaged in what researchers are choosing to pay their patient stakeholder partners. The engagement officers, however, have an eye on this. And so, you know, and our merit reviewers also have an eye on this. So if Kim, sees something that's totally off balance, before they write the contract, they might say, let's visit your budget and talk about what is the disparity I'm seeing, or that there's no compensation, or is this fair compensation. So I think it'll become more of a job of the EO or contracts, and then the contract will get written that way.
I see Steve and Julie.
Can I recommend that we not take a break, because we're going into that time? Are we okay if we not take a 15-minute break, and if some of you need to take a bio break, just, you know, excuse yourself and come back? Okay. Oh, I just have a quick comment, and it's just on the term expertise, and I absolutely agree with all the points that have been mentioned. I just wanted to point out one really important thing, because I teach family center care all the time, but we always talk about the family or the patient being the expert in their care or their child's care, because they live it. So they may not have gone to school to study it, but they've by default fallen into it. So just to point that out in utilizing that term.
Just a quick point question. Has this been shared yet with anyone from an IRB or ethics committee? And if not, is there a plan to do so?
I do think that we need to talk about what the process is from here. Having chaired the compensation subcommittee, I'm about to tell you that our subcommittee is not planning to meet again, and it really is up to us what we do with this going forward at this point.
Initially, when we started this process, we shared that once we have a draft that this particular committee is or panel is comfortable with, we do have an ethics committee on our board, and this is something that we would indeed want to put in their hands, because this will be a policy state or a position statement on our website. And so we would want the ethics committee to review this.
I'm actually going to give Laurel, did you have a chance to make your point or say what you want? Okay, great.
I just have a quick question. So if someone is putting together a grant proposal, say I'm making this up, $200,000, and they've already done the budget, and they've got a strong number of patient, family leaders, stakeholders involved, and they've already done the payment, but it comes up short to be able to do what they need to do for the grant. What would happen, is it feasible if they are able to get funding from an outside source and they can identify that? Does that show that, you know, the buy-in for that, or is that looked down upon? I'm just curious about that.
Yeah, honestly, I don't know if I've seen a situation like that. Now, going forward, what we're hoping that is that in the review and with our engagement officers, we don't get into that situation and that the contract is negotiated based on compensation to everybody involved. If they get involved down the road and they need, you know, they add more, let's say layers, I don't know if there is a limitation within PCORI contract that external funding is not acceptable or is acceptable. That's something that we could find out.
Okay. I'd love to.
Yeah.
Thanks.
I want to thank everyone for your contribution to this. This is not my document by any means, but as the one who was willing to lead the impaneling of a subcommittee on this, I really want to thank the subcommittee. I learned a lot from this process. I mean, it's just there's an amazing amount of information out in this space that I didn't anticipate, and I really want to thank especially Lorraine for bringing some of that data to us and Regina for bringing some, you know, a real feel of what's going on in the world of reality in an unvarnished way. So that was all very helpful, and thanks Sarah and Sue and Suze for participating in this. I think the next step for us really is to decide that we do want to move forward with this as an activity for us, and we do want to suggest a draft framework. There's some wordsmithing that needs to be done. I hope you guys will trust me to do some wordsmithing and send it to Sue for, you know, consideration up the chain either through contracts or through the ethics folks, and to lay it alongside the reimbursement policy that's also coming out of PCORI shortly. The only thing that I think that we've really had some divergence of opinion about is the whole idea of putting in more of an explanation of why people will want to make a commitment of their time and their talent to something like this without compensation, or would defer compensation to the organization that they belong to or that they feel a sense of mission toward. And I'm going to suggest two possible ways to approach that. One is to simply add a line that says, toward at the very end, that says that flexibility might include allowing them to voluntarily opt out of fair compensation out of a sense of commitment to their mission, you know, to put it simply. The other way to approach it is to really take out all of that example. So after the line beginning in the last paragraph, for example, those who receive government benefits and so forth, and through the end would come out of it completely. I'm feeling like I would want to persuade you to go with the idea of keeping these explanations in, because I think we had a lot of dialogue at the early stages of this that, you know, people do have government benefits restrictions and maybe and really use this as a way of not constraining the research team, but of, you know, illustrating the concerns that the patient groups and patient caregivers might have going into this, and giving them some suggestions of considerations they might want to have.
Charlotte, this is, we have one more comment, something we really left out. PCORNET participants. And I'm looking at here in Chicago, we've got a 30-member patient clinician advisory council. And of the 30 members, 12 are community members and patient and family members. And in our conversations the other day, they did mention to us we will be compensated, and they're still determining it, but I know they will look at this statement as guidance to that. And of those 12 or so community members and patients, six are professional level people who do have careers, and they mentioned, they said, this isn't going to be a full-time job. And they didn't get into the conversation of compensation, but I think we need to really consider that as well when we finalize this statement of compensation. The PCORNET participants other than the PIs.
Perry.
Is this the only group that's working on this subject? Is this a policy for all of PCORI?
I think that was the original idea.
Okay. Because that makes a difference.
But I do think, Perry, I think that's an excellent question because as, you know, as we've gone through this, and this has actually taken a while. This is the third meeting that we've talked about this. I think that the longer we linger, the more, you know, people are going to fill in. There's a lot of need for information here. People are going to begin to fill in that gap serially.
I'm all for, you know, there'll always be tinker. Just move it along the pathway. I would strongly encourage that.
This would be a public.
Yes, I really do.
I can offer that two of the things that we have sort of firmly implemented because of our ongoing conversations about this. One is in the PFA itself, so when you're filling out as an applicant, we have a section that says articulate what compensation for stakeholder and partners will be. So we've got sort of an endorsement there in the application process that calls this to mind. And we also, through our town halls and FAQs and other applicant resources, we answer this question about compensation all the time. So we have been providing loose guidance, so we really want you to do this, but we don't have a dollar amount or a rate that we require or recommend. So we've got some things laid into place now, but that's why this policy would be so great to really firm that up.
You know, just briefly on the opt-out, I think it's a personal choice. I think every individual has their own motivation for why they want to do things. I think with this policy, we want to facilitate participation, not create a barrier for participation. So whether that's someone receiving a stipend, opting out of the stipend, or requesting that that stipend go somewhere else, I think those are reasonable things. I mean, we all are entitled to a stipend for participating on this panel, but I personally made a choice to opt out of it because I felt that I wanted to volunteer my time. That doesn't mean I'm any less invested than anyone else at this table. So it's really a personal choice, and I think we really should create a way to facilitate and be inclusive rather than create a barrier.
Charlotte, can I just add there just a suggestion based on what Steve is saying? To move forward with the policy, but maybe as a way to kind of tackle this subject is to, I hate to put anything more on training, but to add it into this research training that, you know, that's being talked about for families and maybe just explaining it, I think is another way that maybe we can handle it.
That's a good suggestion. I think. Laurel.
I just don't know that we need to have that in it that it says that you can, what you can do with it. You can either, it's your personal choice, like Steve said, and that wasn't in our contract when we became members of this committee, I don't believe.
That we can opt out.
The opt out. Mm-hmm.
I mean, I do think we could boil the ocean on this one, just, you know, in terms of, like, really going down granular. I do think we just need to get the policy done. And the question of opting out, I know we specifically put it in there because there are people who cannot serve on panels unless they're permitted to opt out. So,
actually, I think we've often had language. I don't know if we've been consistent, but we have offered language to opt out on compensation. So I think at this point we're going to need to move on to the next topic. And Charlotte, we can work with you on refining this and then create a plan to get this to the ethics committee and we can determine our next steps from there. Okay.
Thank you. Thanks, everyone. Steve, I'll circle back with you.
So at this time, we're going to invite JB and Lorraine to talk about where's JB? Oh, okay. Well, Lorraine, maybe you can I don't know if you and JB planned how you wanted to attack this,
but where do you have the clicker over there?
Okay. I do.
Okay.
I do. So we just breezed through a 15-minute break, so I just want to show us how productive we are when we really put our heads together on this. So I'm going to talk about the Patient Council, which is part of PCORnet. And PCORnet is, for those who aren't aware, PCORnet consists of 11 CDRNs. Those are clinical data research networks. People like Kaiser might be involved on that side of it. Or 11 PPRNs. Those are patient-powered research networks. And those, maybe you'll see somebody like CINA involved with that. CINA is, you know, comes from the Genetic Alliance. So you'll see generally patient advocacy organizations leading research efforts. And these groups have come together to form a network that is a research-based network so that information can come across these organizations and be used for large-scale studies. So it's a way of doing big data research, and it's very innovative and it's very new. I was asked to be on the steering committee and on the executive committee, and soon after I joined, it became apparent that we really needed to have patient counsel because some of the issues that were coming up were issues that were really of central concern to greater than here's a suggestion I have, you know. You could be on a group and you could say, here's a suggestion I had, maybe people will take it or not. But some of the issues that are coming up in PCORnet involve privacy, autonomy, consent. The group is charged with making policies as it goes along, and you can think of it in a way of being a public policy implemented because as a put together a policy, they're immediately putting it into action, and then it becomes part of the outstanding principles on which they operate. So, you know, on research, you know, patients can be involved from a subject to a partnership, which is basically what we were talking about here, but also patients can be involved in something that's a little bit more like participatory democracy, and that's where you're really making public policy decisions that impacts things like autonomy, consent, and privacy. So some of the things that you can do along that line, that continuum that involve patients would include roundtables, a patient council or town hall, and PCORI has implemented a roundtable, and they've recently put together a patient council. We came together in June, and they are intending on doing a town hall. So they're intending on doing a very robust process of public engagement on some of these issues. And I just want to pause for a moment about the patient council and acknowledge the type of flexibility and commitment that PCORI has to patient engagement because when they started off doing PCORnet, they did not have the patient council, but as I started raising some of these issues, they were very receptive to it and we put it in place. So I'm really, I just think this is another indication of the receptivity and encouragement of promoting patient engagement in these projects. So patient councils are like this group. They're deliberative bodies. I don't need to explain much to this group, but this slide actually was from a presentation I gave to our steering committee, and it was a concept that I'm not sure everybody in the room was familiar with. Patient councils are used a lot of times. Places like England use them, Australia, a lot of places where they get the public involved in determining things like research ethics controversies, healthcare policy and reform, public good and personal privacy. And they always create this sort of dynamic tension where the operation becomes less efficient, but it also becomes more robust and more sustainable because the public is more involved and patients are more involved. And this is something that people in this group would be familiar with, but one of the concepts of a patient council is that they need to be informed. And for us, this was a serious issue because there haven't been materials prepared to
educate, inform, and, you know, have a group become empowered to talk meaningfully about concepts like privacy, autonomy, and consent. They can be very complex issues. So one of the tasks that we did was really sort of put together a program of having different people come and talk to the patient council and also putting together reading material for people so that they could become educated on these issues. It's not that anybody had to become an expert, but it's that they had to be able to be conversant in the issues. So that's one of the things that we did. I called it our ramp-up period. We're still going through some of it. Sue has been kind enough to reach out to somebody in Australia who's going to be talking to us about some of the experiences that they have had in trying to implement big data research. Big data research is a controversial topic. So a lot of countries that have tried to adopt, that was just our momentary break there. So a lot of countries that have tried to adopt big data research find that there may be a hiccup. For instance, in the UK, they went to adopt big data research, and they had an opt-out provision for people, whether they wanted to be engaged in the research or not. And they implemented it, and 6 months later, the public went, wait a second. You know, what are we doing here? What are you doing with this data? I regard this data as being private. So they had to go back to the drawing board and rethink some of the ways they were doing it. I think Australia's had a different experience, but all of the countries right now, this is becoming a leading issue because everybody's ready to do big data research. We now have the tools to do it, and people see the value of it, and we need to navigate the space between the old rules of research and what will work more efficiently for this type of research. So the people who are on the panel, this is a panel that is made up of real patients. I emphasize that because Pete Cornett, there are a lot of people who have dual hats, researchers and patients and so forth, but this panel consists of people who are involved in the Pete Cornett network, which means everybody there believes in big data research. But there are also people who are representative of communities. So Bill Clark is with the COPD, organization. Cheryl's working with Greater Plains. Celeste is doing patient engagement at Michigan, and she's working with the vasculitis PPRN. Jessica Burris is with she's with Chronicity, which is about Crohn's disease. Melanie True Hills is with Healthy Heart. And our own Susan Sheridan is with us as well. So some of the questions that we're asking, where we're at right now in the process, is we are just at the very beginning of trying to think through some of the issues. We have policies that we are reviewing, and we were presented with our first policies essentially October 1. So we've been going through a process of trying to identify some of the key issues and get a sense of what some of the considerations might be. So in terms of just framing what we've been looking at, we've been asking questions like, what does patient-centered consent and autonomy look like? What does patient-centered transparency and disclosure look like? And what does patient-centered privacy and confidentiality look like? And this is all occurring in a context. So that this is occurring within the context of the Pete Cornett trials. And some of the activities that will go on will be counts where they just find out how many people have a disease. You know, Kaiser, tell me how many people in your network have diabetes. Or, you know, one of the Genetic Alliance, tell me how many people have X rare disease. And then observational trials would be another, individual randomized trials would be another, and then customized random trials would be another form, and I'm sure there'll be other forms as well. There are laws and regulations that pertain to this, but we
and we have met with legal counsel a number of times, Devin McGraw, who does a fabulous job. And what we were advised to do was to essentially ignore the legal laws because they apply in this situation and not that situation, and they apply to this group of people and not that group of people. So to really sort of come up with some aspirational concepts, not requirements, not things that people have to do, but things that very much like our research rubric, where we have, here's what the ideal looks like, here's what we'd like to see you aspire towards. One thing I should point out is that the clinical data research networks, those are people like Kaiser and so forth, they're all subject to rules like HIPAA. They may be subject to, there's another rule called the common rule that requires consent for research. The PPRNs, the patient-powered research networks, may not be because they're not healthcare providers. So the rules that provide, that pertain to them are very different. They're also a different type of organization in the sense that they're a trusted third-party intermediary, right? I mean, usually if you're going to be part of a data registry, which is what the PPRNs generally have, it's because you've joined a patient community and you're trying to help people compile information on that in the hopes that there'll be research done. And generally, that third-party advocacy organization that you're relying on, you're doing it because you trust that they're going to curate your data well, they're going to protect it, they're going to make sure that it's used for research that matters to patients. So these two roles are very different. You know, your CDRN may be somebody who you see because you have to see them for healthcare. It may or may not be a trusted relationship. So those are some fundamental differences between the two groups. These are some of the concepts that I'm hoping we can explore a little bit here. So one of the issues that we're dealing with is consent. What type of consent is appropriate? And there are a number of different types of consents that I have seen. One would be the blanket consent. You see that, for instance, if you look for a care at UCLA, you'll find that they'll have a consent that says, you come in, we're going to give you treatment, you consent to treatment, you consent to the use of your data, you consent to the use of it for research. I think they even go far enough to say, as you consent to use of your data tissues. So they'll have a blanket consent, and they may have you sign that once or every time that you come. And then there are others that are hybrid consents, and you really are seeing this more with some of the very sophisticated PPRNs will have a consent that'll say, I'm in for anything, check that box. It'll say, I'm not so sure, ask me, let me know the particulars about the research project, or they might say, I don't want you to share my data with anybody. So those might be the three types of ways that somebody who's using a more granular approach might address the problem. And you can even get more granular on that. I mean, I think that the Genetic Alliance, they go down so far in granularity as you can say, I will share this information, but not the information about my mental health, or I'll share that information, but not the information about, my alcoholism or whatever. So you can opt in and out of specific disease context there. And then there's also blanket consents where you have the right to revoke it at any time, and there's, of course, the right to opt out. I mean, everybody has the right to not accept a treatment. And the question is, really comes more along the line of opting out in terms of people using your observational data. So we identified some of the concerns that patients might have and the concerns that we put in high risk. One was the risks that this type of research might pose to autonomy. And I don't think this is obvious, so let me give you an example of it. One of the types of trials that they're talking about doing is called a cluster randomized control trial, which might be that one institution is offering A treatment and one institution is offering B treatment, and then they compare them, and they don't necessarily tell the patients that they're in a research trial or that research is being conducted. You can see that happening a lot of times with operational issues where they decide to try a different hand scrub for hygiene. The example I want to give is it could be used in research on aspirin where you were trying different doses of aspirin to determine the impact on strokes, for instance. Another instance that I found in doing some research on this was there was a trial that was done back some time ago that was on breast cancer, and in one group was patients who were having lumpectomies, and in another group were patients who were having mastectomies. And in that particular piece of research, they didn't tell the patients that they were research subjects. They didn't provide them with treatment options, and that they measured which treatment approach seemed to do the best. The patients were never aware that they were part of a research subject. So in that particular context, you can see that, the issue of autonomy would come up a lot more because you might not know which cancer treatment was best, but one of them involved losing a breast and one of them didn't. So the individual patient would be an issue that an individual patient would care about quite a bit. And then the other high-risk issue we saw was privacy, and that was, de-identified data versus personal health information versus re-identification. So those would be the places where privacy comes up. So some of the issues that I wanted to throw out to the group for consideration, one was our blanket consent. Inappropriate as a sole option for treatment. And I think maybe I should just stop there and let people respond and give comments and questions, and then we can go on to other questions.
I guess I'd just like some clarification. So on the blanket consent, I understand what that looks like at a system level. I guess I'm wondering from PCORnet's perspective, are you suggesting that there would be a blanket consent as part of being a member of the PPRN or CDRN, or that it would be a project-by-project blanket consent? I'm just not clear where that comes in.
So a blanket consent could come in, for instance, on a PPRN might have a blanket consent at when you sign up for their process that you consent to any and all uses of your information. The same thing could happen in a institution. You could go into an institution and it could have, I think we're used to seeing blanket consents in institutions where the ability to use the data information subsequently in observational trials would be permitted based on the initial consent. So the question is, on like an observational situation, do they have to come back to you each time they're doing a new observational trial, or can you is consent up at the beginning enough? Do you need to know who's doing the research, what the research is about? Those are some of the concepts. And one of the things that we talked about on the patient council was whether that was appropriate as a sole option or whether people ought to also be offered the option of opting out or requiring that there be individual consent. So that sort of frames that question a little bit better, I think.
So I want to provide a little additional information around how consent processes are actually being developed within the network. Particularly for the PPRNs, consent is really being done with really robust, thorough patient input. So generally, if they have decided, so some of our, particularly our rare disease PPRNs, some of them have decided to do an upfront one-time consent. And that has really been at the will of the patients and the families that are involved in the governance and participation of those organizations. Many of these consents have actually been drafted like line by line with the participation of these communities.
I think one of the other areas, Lorraine, please let me know if I'm correct here, is trying to figure out where this line would be in recommending some aspirational guidance to also our clinical data networks around what kind of guidance they can provide some of these larger health systems that are doing research around I think Lorraine's example is great in that she gives an example of, you know, two doses of aspirin. You really don't know which is the most effective dose of aspirin. So to do that kind of a randomized controlled trial, you wonder do you just need to inform patients? Is that enough? Do you need consent for something like that when autonomy is not such an issue? But the other example she gave is kind of the other side of that, where there's clinical equipoise, but it significantly affects the autonomy of patients in terms of losing a breast versus not losing a breast in the case of a lumpectomy. So I think what would be helpful is to hear from you all, where should the line be with respect to randomized controlled trials and opting out for some of our clinical data networks as well?
I just want to clarify, they're probably, if you're doing a randomized controlled trial, usually you're going to be getting consent, but not in the randomized cluster, not in the cluster. So that's where that becomes an issue. But even otherwise, the question is, what does an ideal consent look like in terms of the patient? Certainly people want it to be something, a form that they can read and understand, but what does ideal consent look like in terms of from the patient perspective?
I think I'm still just a little unclear. I understand that, you know, that there are different groups doing different things, but I guess what I'm trying to get a sense of, and help me, Lorraine, figure out how we can best help give you some feedback on this. Let's say, for example, I am part of a PPRN, and that PPRN chooses to use blanket consent. Does that then mean that whenever there's something that's going to be studied or a research question is going to be posed, that I would not then be engaged about participating in it, that my data itself would just simply be starting to be used? And I'm not saying that's right or wrong. I'm simply trying to get clarity on it. Or would there be, and I see the distinction you're making between the clustered randomized trial and another type of randomized trial, but I'm still trying to get my head around whether or not I'm going to be aware as a member of that PPRN of the activity that may be happening with the data that I have contributed.
That's a really good question. I think you may not be. If it's observational and there's no treatment intervention and there's a blanket consent, you may not be. I mean, some of it would depend on the individual organization. Some organizations might elect to give you notice that a trial has been done. Some might elect to get back to you and give you results. I mean, certainly there's the incentive to do that with the PPRNs. With the CDRNs, you may not know at all, because they may not check back in with you. You may not be asked for consent. So you may not know that you're a research subject or that there's something going on there.
So I'll just follow up then with our own experience. So we would be considered a PPRN. And so as a user of patients like me, people come in through user agreement. Any data they're adding to their profile is subject to use in terms of answering certain questions that we might have. However, when we create a specific project, that project is subject to a review process that would suggest either we have an IRB, first of all, review, but also, you know, what information do we need to convey to the patient about who's our partner in this? Oftentimes it's an external partner. What's our objectives? What are our goals for that? So we see a couple of it's quite distinctive. So one would be observational in that data that you've added to your profile is simply going to be used for various questions that we try to answer. But then when we're specific about it and we've got a particular project that's going to, especially involving external researchers, we would then be very specific about not only
determining the human subject issues and things like that, but also intentionally inviting patients to participate with a full explanation of what we were going to be doing and how the data would be shared back to them, and then giving that they also have an opt-out. So just to give you our experience on those two kinds of things.
So when you're that's really useful, Sally. So when you're talking about the observational trial, so does a patient know when somebody's using their observational data?
Let's say, for example, we're doing a not necessarily. You know, I think if we're working with an external researcher, they know. There's always a – because we have a process for that review to be discussed internally and then to determine how we're going to introduce that to the patient. Part of the issue of doing that is that we want to be sure that the patients are also getting an awareness that there will be some questions answered as a result of the participation in this, and you will get the findings back. So they actually are aware of that. However, that said, I might be doing some review of our fibromyalgia community, and I can download our data set about our fibromyalgia community and simply start to answer questions based on the data that we have available in our warehouse, our data warehouse, without necessarily saying to the patients, oh, I'm going to start looking at these particular questions about fibromyalgia. Now, that may lead me to a more sophisticated question and study that I might engage another partner with to sort of take it further. But based on the data that's been provided on the profile, we have the user's agreement as part of their sign-on process to use that data to answer specific questions.
Are the data de-identified when you use them?
Yes, it's always de-identified when we use the data, and we do it in aggregate. So.
I think a little bit this prompted me to think about social media, and it's probably, a bigger question for the PPRNs than CDRNs that have more of a data infrastructure. With the PPRNs, that's probably more likely to have some type of social media component that could be complementary to other data collection efforts. And, it's something to think about in terms of building this out, how to appropriately incorporate and use social media or publicly available information where someone has posted something or they have disclosed personal information. How can that appropriately be used is a big question. And it's something, we wrestle with, I think FDA has been wrestling with as well. The use of social media.
Can I just follow up on that? Because I think it is an important distinction to understand that certainly in our situation, we de-identify all of the data that we use when we're using it for any particular research purposes, and that's very clearly told to patients so they know that. But I think you raise another very valuable point for the PPRNs because they oftentimes have been created in a technological world that didn't exist when some of these health systems created themselves, right? So there's the likelihood of them having more sophisticated or technological solutions to some of this might be actually more robust than some of the systems themselves and probably less complicated because they're not subject to some of the same, even though they're subject to legislation that has to do with privacy, they're not necessarily subject to HIPAA and that sort of stuff. So I think you raise a good point that, what the PPRNs might be able to do is to have a few different ways of doing this and then do some evaluation on how are those working. And then have someone, maybe at the end of the 18-month project, be able to say, well, getting some feedback as to the kind of responses that patients had in relationship to the particular consents that were used for particular projects. But I think the piece for me is that it feels to me like a blanket consent in a PPRN as the sole option doesn't seem appropriate. In a health system where, you're part of the system of care, actually I think it makes more sense than it does in a PPRN where you're engaging people in a way of being able to say some of this information we're going to be using is observational in nature, but then some of it is going to also be quite specific in nature. And we may have other partners involved that we need to tell you about. I think that's the distinction I'm trying to make. I don't know if that's helpful or not.
So you're always using the ability to opt out, though. And what about the question of you're using de-identified data.
are you looking at, you know, the prospect of re-identifying data either through, I know, blue button technology or that sort of thing? Is there, I mean, and if you re-identify data, or do you have other researchers who are thinking of re-identifying data? And in that instance, would you go back and reconsent?
We're just beginning a few projects in that realm, and I think what we tend to do is to put the controls in the hands of the patient. So if we are going to be deciding that we're going to pull in data, and we're working on a couple of experimental projects on that right now, so we're pulling in some data through a blue button functionality that would come in. The patient will have had to give consent for that to get pulled in. They will have to give consent for them to push it back out if we were to also do something in a bidirectional way. So the control, I use oftentimes the sort of the image of a joystick when someone's on a video game. So if this is the patient and this is their data and they're saying, okay, well, I want to pull my data in from my EHR into my patient portal, and then I'm going to take that data that's in my patient portal and push it off to patients like me, they're the ones within that process that are actually making the consent happen. So that's the way we would approach that.
Okay, I think that's very useful, and we're at a really early stage in this, so, I mean, this may be as far as we can go with this right now, and perhaps I'll hand it back to you, JB, and you had missed the introduction to give sort of some background on this.
So I was going to give Lorraine a nice introduction because she really has worked so hard to help us conceive this idea of the patient council, and really our program director at PCORnet, Rachel Florence, has been incredibly supportive, and this is a substantial amount of work. And when I was here during my fellowship, this was sort of the last thing I did before I'd gone back to school, was help put together this patient council. And to Lorraine's point, you know, we were able to do a nomination process within PCORnet that enabled us to find some really, really passionate patients who have, you know, a variety of viewpoints that are helping us consider many different things. And now that we're really in the policymaking phase of the network, we're really ramping up to, you know, move these policies through the approval process. It's wonderful to have Lorraine on board with this patient council to explore these issues. What I wanted to do is I was not sure how much conversation this would generate, and I really wanted to leave plenty of time for that, but I had distributed the patient and family engagement rubric that we had adapted for infrastructure development to you all. You received it, I think, before the meeting, and you have it in your printed materials. And This rubric has really been really well integrated and adapted into the concepts of infrastructure development, because as we spoke about last January, in looking at this particular 18-month phase one project, there's no research going on. So in really trying to help provide technical assistance and develop milestones, we needed to take the concepts that you all, these aspirational concepts that you all had developed for engaging patients in research and find a way to do something similar for the phases of infrastructure development. And I'm really pleased to tell you that this has really been embraced both internally at PCORI by our infrastructure program, by the coordinating center that we are working with, and by the networks as well. And what we're really seeing is that it's providing some very useful guidance, and we're seeing evidence of that now in the network. And so I thought I'd tell you a little bit about, I've been in the field considerably since I started officially as the engagement officer for PCORnet. And I wanted to tell you a little bit about one of the CDRNs and some of the work that they're doing, and they've used the rubric to really guide some of their processes, because some of you had also asked about what engagement would look like in these CDRNs. Our Greater Plains Collaborative CDRN is a network that covers 7 different states and 10 institutions throughout that state. The majority of those institutions are in the Midwest. There's one institution from Texas that participates in that network. And before I left, they had been really trying to explore how they were going to bring patients together from all
10 institutions and have them meaningfully involved in developing the network. And so what they decided to do is they really heavily invested in bringing these patients together to not only provide some education around what kind of work they would wanted to do within the Greater Plains Collaborative, but also to determine what the patients want out of this network as well. And so they had a two-day conference in August in Kansas, and it was at Kansas University Medical Center. And they planned a very robust agenda where they spent one day orienting patients to the network. They had a jargon watch, and so there was a process in place where if patients were not familiar with some of the terminology that was being used, we stopped and everybody was able to catch up. And they also brought in a graphic facilitator to help make sure that the bidirectional conversation that was going on was captured and then that it was really understood by both sides, the patients and the research and healthcare community that's involved in that network. They spent the next day having the patients sit down and provide information on how to better, how to really embed research into care from the patient perspective. How do patients want to learn about research? How do they want to see it embedded into the care process? How do they want to provide data? How do they want to be involved in data collection? Spent a lot of time getting great input from patients on how this will actually happen in the network. The other thing that they did is that each CDRN has three cohorts. Everybody has an obesity cohort. That's our PCORI-mandated condition. And then they have one common condition and then one rare disease. And so their rare disease is ALS, and their common condition is breast cancer. And so each of those groups sat down and talked about how to actually characterize the cohort. So they were actively involved in cohort characterization. The ALS group also sat down with a couple of ALS patients and also really went through the survey that they had developed and really provided a lot of updated changes that they should consider, and all those changes were integrated into the new survey that's going out to the ALS community. So these are some of the examples that we're seeing. Most of the networks at this point, they are, to Regina's point, they may not have figured out all of the pieces, like the compensation piece, but at this point, most of the networks have developed their structure for governance. There are patients involved in all of the governance structures. And what's encouraging is we're not just learning about which patients are involved, but how these patients are involved. So how patients are being involved and making sure that the research topics that the patients submit to networks are actually being prioritized and considered. And I'll give you one example. Our About Network, which is the Hereditary Breast and Ovarian Cancer Network, has developed a very robust process where they are taking all of the information and ideas on research that they get from their patient communities, from social media, from their hotline for their phone, from their community that's online, that's internal to About. And they're taking all of these ideas and they're putting them into what they call a research generator and percolator. And then what they do is they go through each and every one of them, and they see if there has been anything in the literature. They'll do a literature scan and see if those questions have been addressed yet. And whatever has not been addressed then goes to their governance community for further consideration to look at the feasibility of conducting that research and to prioritize those questions that come from patients. So these are some of the promising practices that we're seeing. We've also developed a repository that will eventually be fit for public consumption for the networks to really share these practices and learn about how they're doing. Some of the research topic prioritization is something that they really struggled with in New York City, the New York City CDRN. So I've been able to share with them how this is being done in some of our PPRNs and with some of our other clinical data networks so they can implement a similar process. So that's a snapshot into what's going on. I would be happy to take any questions about other patient engagement initiatives in PCORnet.
I have a question if there's no one else.
Regina? I can hear
you. Yes.
Okay.
Okay. Now, thank you for the presentation. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Did you have a question, or are you just saying thank you?
You know, I do have a question.
Okay.
No, I'm on the PCAC, Patient Clinician Advisory Council, for the CDRN in Chicago. You know, one of the purposes of our committee is to provide guidance on the governance of the data that's going to be used, and assist in the evaluation of our requests for internal investigators. So it's really, I'm thankful to hear the work that's being done at PCORI regarding this. One of the questions that I do have is, because we're going to be getting guidance from what's being done there, I see that there may be a need for a little more educational for the patient members and community members of these CDRNs and PPRNs. I don't know if that's your experience from what you're hearing from the other ones, but I think there might be a need for that overall. Can you share anything you're doing with that?
So you're talking about training for patients who are participating in PCORNet networks? And
PCORNet. That's right.
Okay.
Yeah, the ones on the committees and whatnot.
So this is something that we are working on. We have in the central desktop repository, we have 15 different trainings that have been contributed one way or another. One is actually from the FRAT network. So this is the network that I spoke about, that the hereditary breast and ovarian cancer. So they had developed patient training prior to their involvement with PCORNet. And then once they joined PCORNet, they updated their training to include some key modules on consent and participating in networked research and comparative effectiveness research as well. So we have several different trainings, and what I'm really doing right now is working with our training coordinator, Erica Sarnes at PCORI, to talk about how we can develop some training that we could use across the network. So stay tuned for that, because this is you're not the only one in the network who's asked about training that could be used just across the network. It seems to be a theme from the entire PEEP as well, just coming up with some sort of blanket training for PCOR in general.
Thank you. Okay.
I'd like to ask the PEEP this dialogue. We seem to be kind of disengaged. And so I'm wondering, does this group understand PCORNet? Does this group understand the opportunities for patient engagement in infrastructure development, for developing a data research network? Is that something that's foreign to this group, or is it outside of our scope? Is this something that we need to really kind of step back and reframe what we're talking about in terms of PCOR? Is very complicated, and it's taken a lot of us a long time to really understand, number one, the structure, number two, what's really going to happen, what's the research that's really going to take place, what does it look like? So I'd like to get some feedback from you. Is this something that is that we need to step back and do a better explanation about what PCORNet is with you, so we can come back in and talk about some of these more granular concepts? Because this is very complicated. Steve?
Maybe one way to kind of address that is, I mean, we could do this via WebEx or teleconference prior to our next meeting, but you know, maybe have you guys walk us through a little bit what the RFPs for these types of studies look like. Obviously there's an infrastructure and building capacity component, but at the end of the day, I think everybody's interest probably lies in what these studies are going to look like, and maybe if there can be some kind of discussion around examples of the types of studies or what's being asked of the folks that will be submitting proposals eventually, that might put a little bit more form and structure around it for us.
So I would be happy to do that. I don't think we're quite there yet. We're talking about proof of concept studies. We're talking about just even developing an RFP for phase two. So I don't think we're quite there. What I can do for you all, though, is recently we've compiled a number of use cases, and these use cases I'll have to vet them through our science department to see which ones we could bring in. But I think that might be very useful, is to go through maybe two or three different use cases around how PCORnet will be leveraged to conduct patient-centered outcomes research patient-centered outcomes research. I'd like to see, that was an excellent question, though, because I know that we've presented twice on PCORnet. We've had Rachel Florence come. We've presented to you all on the structure of the network, you know, what the network is made up of, what we're doing. There's usually been a lot of questions, and I think since we're not to the point, Steve, that you talked about, like, where we're really seeing RFPs on the studies yet, maybe you just don't have any further questions right now. But to Sue's point, I'd like to know if there's anything else that would be helpful for you to understand as we guide this work.
I just wanted to make a comment. It would be helpful to understand more. I'm on a parent partner on PEDSnet. And it's taken me a long time to kind of familiarize myself, and it is very confusing. And on that note, I think it's even extra confusing for somebody who doesn't live in that world. And I know that you're talking about the training materials that are already on there. I know that one thing our group has done that has been very helpful is before a board meeting, and I'm on the board, I'm one of the parent partners on the board, to offer to those who may not have that expertise in whether it's IRB issues or privacy issues, to walk through some of the documents before the actual meetings. And I do have to say that has really helped out tremendously and helped me engage much more so in the conversation.
Yeah, that's great to hear. We actually have provided significant guidance to the task forces. So, if you remember, PCORnet is made up of 11 task forces on a variety of issues like ethics, regulatory. We also have a PRO's task force. So we've gone through those task forces. But in really helping patients effectively engage the patients who are sitting on those task forces, most task forces have patient representation. We've had to go back and really work with the task forces who have maybe not, some of the people have not worked with a lot of patients, and a lot of them are doing that. They'll have like a pre-call to really go through the materials and help the patients understand like really what the issues are and the kind of input that they're looking for. So I'm glad to hear that your network is doing that as well.
My answer to the question would be yes. I think most of my exposure that I can walk away with has come from really informal conversations and talking to Lorraine. And my real test of whether – my test is, can I explain this to my constituents? And I probably would need some help at the top of the funnel to explain this.
For me, I think you've heard from some of the folks here, they'd like a little more understanding of the issues confronting this infrastructure development and patient roles. You know, sometimes what we just need from you is better setup. And so, and I wasn't able to be here yesterday, and I apologize for that. It was not my intent. But I was sitting here processing this infrastructure document and thinking and reflecting on sort of what I know to be the issues, but I wasn't quite sure where to insert myself. And I think what we've learned as a PEEP is the greater sort of more granular, just we really understand how something works, the more we're able to attach our kind of perspective and our knowledge to it. So, for example, I think there are big issues about supporting these organizations to really deliberate on some really important and powerful issues that they're going to need tools to support them with, quite frankly. I don't quite know how to insert this in this conversation because I don't quite know. There's like too many things I could insert. Does that make sense? And this is where I think as a PEEP we tend to struggle. We're sort of not quite sure the key things. And so I do think a conversation that's about that, and let's talk about what are the big issues that are the policy issues or the practice issues what people are going to struggle with, and then we're going to be much more able to give you input. Because I want to start inserting stuff around deliberation, but I don't know if it's timely, right? So, and then, you know, I just don't know what to say today. And that's unusual for me, but I really don't. So if that's helpful, okay.
Stephen?
Yeah, I mean, so the answer for me is yes. I mean, there was kind of two issues here. First, I'm not sure if this is the right body to make provide guidance to Corey on things like data privacy and patient autonomy. I mean, they're fairly complex legal issues. Although I know we have some attorneys on the group here. But also, I got thrown when we started talking about randomized clinical trials being run out of the CDRNs or the PPRNs because I thought they were distributed research networks that were basically data repositories, and then researchers could go back and patients could go back in and mine the data. And if we're running RCTs off of the distributed research networks, I guess we're talking about, like Lorraine said, re-identification of data and using it as recruitment tools. And now we have issues of consenting patients for each of those RCTs. And, I mean, I mean, methodologically I get it, but it's beyond the scope of what I could competently comment on as far as informed consent.
So that, and we, there is a clinical trials task force within PCORnet, and their work recently commenced. They're coming out with their guidance, and I think that the next time that we get together, we could spend some time talking about what those trials look like within the network. And Sarah Dougherty, my colleague, who's a senior program officer for PCORnet for nine of the common condition PPRN, she has some leadership on that task force, and I think it'd be great to have her here to talk about that.
Stephen, you bring up a topic that you know, you don't know if this group is has the expertise to address some of these issues, and we also have access to experts, but somehow we have to communicate what this data network is to the public because we have all probably been involved in research, honestly, with our data, and we just don't know it. And so it does affect all of us in a way that we want to get feedback from just a really, like, whoa, really, consent and privacy, and we don't want expertise. We want, you know, patient feedback, reactions. And quite frankly, it's because some data research networks, and one that we follow very closely over in England, has been derailed because the public pushed back saying, whoa, what about my privacy? They gave they were given the option to opt out for a certain period of time. If they didn't opt out, they were in. And so we followed this kind of public derailment of the data network because of the public. Not because of, and they sought expertise, and they actually sought some public input. So we're trying to be as transparent as possible and really reach out to, I mean, you are expert patients in one way. You're with your communities and with your organizations, and so we're hopeful to bounce off some concepts just to get your reaction to some of this, because we have to be able to communicate, and there will be reactions from the public when this goes live, and so that's why we want to bring topics to you, as well as the council, and as well as other convenings, just so we can have this conversation, understand what is the reaction. And first of all, I think the reaction is we don't understand it, because honestly, none of us have really had to have these conversations, unless you've been a subject in a clinical trial and really had to sign consent and understand when you're randomized and what that means. But for the general public, I think there's a lot of, we've never really known about this. So I think we can come with a different approach, or maybe some preparation, some materials, yes, use cases, and some, you know, really share what some of these networks are sharing of the CDRN was really good, but just some really concrete examples of where maybe the PPRNs are getting stuck right now, you know, that like in terms of recruiting diversity, and you know, we can maybe put some of those issues on the table, and we can talk about that. But I really encourage us to have this dialogue amongst staff, because, well, we're the PEEP, and also this is, you know, the PCORnet is venturing into new territory, and we need guidance from you know, patient leaders.
I'm gonna go back around again, just so we don't miss anybody.
Yeah, I just wanted to add on that. I think that communication piece and the transparency, you guys need to really, really think hard about. You know, I've done retrospective studies, you know, database studies, EMR studies. I probably have never thought about it, but I've probably been a number in some study that someone else ran, and I've never thought about it that way. And I think you know, when you start having that conversation, you know, you're going to get a lot of different types of reactions from people, and you want to make sure, you know, that you don't lose control of that conversation and it doesn't wind up being death panels over again. You know, that people understand that the purpose and you know, that this goes on, and really you're going to have to manage. It's a tricky situation that you guys are going to have to manage, because I don't think the public is aware a lot of these activities, even though they go on a daily basis through multiple different organizations. There's a lot that's out there, and I don't think there's a lot of awareness around
this. We did hear from our New York City CDRN that when they were consenting a patient and talking about how they've been using their data for QI purposes, like, they were just floored. They were so upset about it. So that's just Sally. So that's two comments. One that sort of brings me back to the comment I made this morning with Joe, and that is that, you know, I think a lot of what PCORI has put itself out as is to, you know, be about, you know, patient engagement and research. And so I think we really, you know, most patients don't think about their clinical data being used in terms of research. However, in our studies on data sharing, we have learned that patients actually do believe that we do something with their data that improves care. So, and when they learn that we probably don't do that very often, they're not too happy about it. So I think it's a communication and messaging issue. I think if you continue to harp on the sort of the engagement and research piece and forget that really what we're trying to do is improve health and healthcare through understanding and answering questions and measuring things effectively, then I think people will get stuck on the research piece and get a little uncertain about what it is you're exactly doing. And we end up, I think, with a lot of uncertainty and questions. So I would think about reframing the messaging a little bit. I think also it's a good example, you know, when you came and asked us a couple of questions here just about consenting, you know, I happen to be a representative of the largest PPRN in the world, actually, at the moment. And, you know, even for me, I sat here saying, well, what exactly are they asking? So I think you have 11 task force. You're studying these questions intensely. You have experts who are advising you on a lot of these things. I think what it would be helpful would be to bring us back things to contemplate from those groups, to say, okay, here's where they got, and I think that was some of this framing, but it wasn't clear enough. So I think that would be much more helpful. So I think what we could then say, in our perspective, based on what you're asking us to consider, thank you for bringing us the perspectives of the experts in this, and now we can give you our input on it from an engagement perspective. And I think that would actually be more fruitful, because I think for most people, thinking about this isn't something they're doing every day. I do, because we're doing it every day. But so that might be why I thought your question was great, too. It's like everybody doesn't seem totally engaged in this conversation. But I don't think it's relevant enough for most of us to be able to contribute effectively and meaningfully at the moment. So.
I was just thinking that perhaps it needs to be more lay-oriented and maybe more of a framework to this so that we would understand it better. Not everybody, I mean, we do understand consent and we do understand de-identifying information, but if we take this to patients, they're going to ask a lot of questions, and so we need to be able to have that information and that background, which we would then have as a subsequent document that would come.
I know we have to move on, but I think we need to provide you with something a little more concrete. I just want to, can we take real quick from Kristen?
Yeah, I think a couple of things. What's really important is to understand, and what we can share with you, is what are not just technical solutions. I actually feel incredibly strongly that when we are talking about things where there is not a simple technical solution, values come into play, privacy, access, use, are things about messaging, but they're also about including the community in the decisions about that. And so one of the things we can help you recognize is this is not a technical question, this is a value question, and once it becomes a value question, then there's both sort of our input, but then thinking about what is PCORI going to do to get the public input, because what happened in England was the public did not have a mechanism to have a deliberation about how this would be used, and that's an informed view of things. I had, just as a point of information, I know Jean, I don't think is here right now, I can't see. Hi, Jean. So hello, Jean. I know it's been out, but I told you about the public deliberation project. ARC has a tremendous number of resources on public input into these issues. The final report on the granular details of all the lessons learned on methods have been held up for publication purposes, but it's about to come out very soon. But if you're interested, yes, I know. It's almost in publication. It's social science and medicine that's holding us up. But it's really important and critical, and I want to put a very strong stake down that getting public input into these questions is going to be how the public buys into the use and dissemination, and you don't get that backlash, but also it's the right thing to do. And I'll leave it at that for now. We do need further conversation.
And Kristen, I remember you bringing this up at the last PEAT meeting, and I have a meeting this afternoon at 3:30 to talk about a convening that will be inviting public input about. So it was based on your proposition.
Well, and Jean knows a lot about this now too, so you know.
So it's interesting that you brought this up because this morning I had suggested to Sue that one of the things. As many of you know, I've been here for 7 months, but before I was here, I directed comparative effectiveness research at AHRQ, and one of what I consider our sentinel project there was the convening of what we called the community forum. And part of that was stakeholder engagement, but the other part was developing a randomized controlled trial of deliberative juries, which are often used in other settings. A deliberative jury is where you take people essentially off the street who have no priors and you give them evidence about controversial subjects, like where would you place a toxic dump? If you have to close down 5 schools, which schools would you choose? What criteria would you use? And it's in the United States, it hasn't been used very often in healthcare. So this was a project that was done using healthcare topics. The reason I bring that up is because the videotapes of the juries or deliberative juries were fascinating. How people make decisions and what information they want and how they influence each other's behavior, and I thought it might be a nice presentation for the PEAT. And so I've just been waiting for the papers to get published, to get them out into the literature, so I don't have to be a nag anymore.
Just on that note, I mean, it just makes me think about methods for public engagement, and it may be useful for our panel to, you know, we talk a lot about the need to engage and why it's important, less so on the how, and maybe it would be a good exercise to share different ways that engagement can take. I know some of that's reflected in the rubric, but more from a method and an implementation standpoint, it might be useful for the group to understand how these things happen on the ground.
I just wanted to reemphasize that we're talking about patient engagement in research, but really research is on a continuum to patient care. Patient engagement in research is patient care, so that we should focus on the patient care part, and that would be more acceptable. Patients will find that a different level of activity would be. Okay, I'm done.
Great dialogue, and I'm sorry to cut it off, but I hope we can continue this kind of dialogue next time. And at this point, we are running behind, but Suzanne is going to lead a discussion on two issues also that could be relatively new for this group. It is, you know, research specific. It's about IRBs. You've heard some discussion about IRBs, and I'm using a lot of acronyms right now, DSMBs, but Suzanne's going to tell you what they are and why we're bringing this up right now.
Hi, and I've got about -9 minutes to do this, so I'll be very quick. And really, this is just, we could spend a whole 2 days covering just these topics. So this is just going to be a very high level. I want to give you a bit of an update on kind of the questions that are coming to us and the requests that are being made of PCORI for guidance. And just sort of offer them up to the group. We will not have time to reach any manner of resolution today, but I want to raise them, and then if these are things that you're particularly interested in, it would be great to keep connecting with you as we move forward. And I just have the topic slide. I don't have any materials for this. And it actually flows really well from the conversation we've just been having about consent and privacy and all of these really tricky human subjects protection issues. I'll start with privacy, because the privacy concerns on sort of the other side of our research portfolio, not PCORnet, but just our regular portfolio, are present as well. And so these are a little bit different. It's not really about concern over data and sharing, although that can apply too. This is more just very general. If I'm a patient partner on a team and my name is in the public domain, should that be concerning, or is it something that we need to think more clearly about? What we have requested right now is that when there is an application, you list your primary patient and primary stakeholder partners so that they can be recognized on the public abstract. And that was actually in response to a pretty loud call from the patient community saying it's not really fair that the PI's name is the only one that's up there if we're all very invested in this work. But we always have to balance that with if you don't want your name out there and attached with a condition or whatever that sort of communication is, then what should we do about that and how should we manage that? So that's one piece that has come up quite a bit. I've also fielded several calls from funded teams, so projects that are already funded, already underway, who are themselves struggling with patient partners that are on the team, and if they are engaged in conversations about their own medical conditions as part of their contribution to the team, again, these are not subjects. These are partners. They're research partners, maybe even a co-PI on the team. Should we provide some guidance, and it could go back to training, everything does, is Erica in the room? Is it just about having a conversation about, we think it's great that you're energized and want to be involved in this. Be mindful that if you're at a meeting and sharing this information, just think all the way through to how in-depth you want to get, how candid you want to be. And I'm not saying that's what we need to do. I'm posing this as a question, just to be provocative. These are the kinds of questions I'm getting. That's privacy. In terms of IRBs and DSMBs, and so if you're not familiar with IRBs, these are institutional review boards. These are usually, you know, each university has an IRB. We had a conversation yesterday about universal IRB that you could use across several study sites. There's a lot of permutations of this. But generally speaking, with our work on the non-PCORnet side, each institution that is a recipient of funding has an IRB, and in order to move forward with your research that involves human subjects, you have to get approval from your IRB. As you can imagine, I mean, IRBs have been around forever. People have been getting IRB approval forever, but we are putting this brand new piece into the mix that is really creating confusion and resulting in a lot of questions for us, either at the application stage or among funded awardees. One of the sort of foundational questions is, how can I involve patient partners on my team
and start amassing my work, you know, get going without receiving IRB approval? Wouldn't I need to wait until I have IRB approval before I can engage my patient partners? So our sort of very high-level response has been, well, no, not if these are patient partners. These are not the subjects. These are not the participants in the research. But what we have seen, what has sort of surfaced through our portfolio is it's not necessarily that clean. There are people who play multiple roles. There's the patient who's the co-PI, and that's clearly, that's a partner. That is not a subject. And then there's people who are clearly subjects. But what about sort of this middle ground? What about people who are involved in focus groups or targeted interviews? And could one person be playing sort of several different roles? And how do we provide guidance as a funder to people who are applying or people who are already funded in terms of working with an IRB to just help tease this all out? Because it is, it's brand new, and there's really not places to go to get feedback for this, these types of really weighty issues. There's a flip side of that, which is for those patient partners who are serving as team members and clearly are not subjects, they themselves need to undergo training to be able to participate in human subjects research. I mean, think about all that. This is what I spend my day thinking about. So is there something PCORI should be doing? Do we need to occupy a space where we provide training or point people to appropriate resources? And there's the city training. But we've actually heard from several teams that the city training itself is too complicated for some of their patient partners. So where can we send these people to be trained appropriately for their participation? So that's sort of the gamut of IRB work. And then lastly, I think of IRB as front end, and then DSMB is a monitoring board, really more focused on data safety and privacy. And these are only triggered in some studies. It's not every study at PCORI that needs a DSMB. There's certain trigger points, and we won't get into all of that. But because we're PCORI, we really want to think differently about even DSMBs. And so those studies at PCORI that have to put together a data safety monitoring board, should we require that a DSMB has a patient representative? And if so, how do we occupy that space? Do we want to put a call out and ask people if they want to be engaged as representatives on DSMB? This is very difficult work. I mean, it's hard enough sort of what... Sure, so the DSMB is really, it's an oversight body that watches for any concerns around safety of the study, privacy, just all of the things we were talking about related to PCORI, sharing of information. Does anything seem potentially risky, harmful during the life of the study? And the DSMB actually would have the prerogative to shut a study down if there were major concerns with it. So this is not without significant import. If you are a member of a DSMB, that's a big job. But again, we're PCORI and we're different, and we fund research that's very different. So we've talked a lot about, should we have patients serving on these DSMBs, and how should we facilitate that? What should PCORI's role be in doing that? Do we need to provide training? Do we need to provide people, like go find patients to sort of plug into DSMBs? So those are, you know, these are all enormous, thick bioethical challenges. I love this kind of stuff. That's why I do it. Great. So we already have input. Go ahead, Steve. Was Lorraine up first?
So these are some great issues. I'm glad that you guys are tackling these. You know, on the question of IRB, you know, I remember, you know, the October 2012 workshop, you know, the one right before the hurricane. That was one of the questions I had coming into that meeting. You know, it's like, okay, you know, I know what I need to do if I'm doing a study. You know, but if I want to engage a patient, what do I need to do that? And do I need to go through an IRB? And I think it's a lingering question that's out there, you know, that's still a barrier for people to understand the how-to. So I think it's great that if PCORI can provide clarity, release a statement, because that, I think, will facilitate more interaction and more engagement. On the subject of the DSMB, I think there absolutely is a role for patient engagement there, because when we're talking about monitoring, right, we don't want to just look at the risk side of the equation. You know, we need to look at the balance and trade-off between benefit and risk, and only the patient is able to be able to provide their perspective on what is an acceptable level of risk relative to the benefit, you know, for their unmet needs, their conditions. And I think there's absolutely a central role for patients to play in that process. And obviously it's a much more complicated process. So there definitely does need to be capacity building or training to be able to interpret and understand the data and the decisions and the dialogue around those kinds of topics.
I just want to say I really appreciate your thoughts, and if anyone has experience or resources that they want to offer up, I've been scouring. I've been reaching out to everyone I know, particularly in the CBPR space, community-based participatory research, and there's some work in CBPR that kind of gets close to this, but in terms of finding DSMBs where patients have served and having examples to pull from, it is very thin.
So, I think one of the challenges is there are different ways of running data safety monitoring boards. Some are institutionally run, some are external bodies. They really become important when patient accrual is not proceeding at a fast enough pace, and, you know, making decisions about futility and when to shut down a study in futility is a scientific term that means that even if you basically accrue all the patients, you won't be getting study results that would be meaningful in any way. And so those are bioethical issues that I think patients have a very strong voice in. I think patients are on a lot of DSMBs, but I think a lot of DSMBs are under the radar screen, and people just and especially those that are PI initiated, which a lot of for low to moderate risk, most funding agencies will allow the principal investigator to establish their own DSMB.
And I think this is a topic where, you know, as different stakeholder representatives, maybe this is the kind of topic that, you know, we could take back to our communities, and see if there's a way to, you know, bring information back to inform PCORI as well, you know, through other routes.
So I agree on the DSMB. I think that's important. I wanted to point out that on the patient privacy issue, there's a countervailing issue, too, and the other one is whether somebody is actually and authentically a patient representative. So in our community, we have an organization we call AstroTurf, which is a fake grassroots organization. And in controversial issues, you can get this where one side puts, the wolf puts on sheep's clothing. So I would be concerned if a patient wasn't willing to stand up and be known so that their community can acknowledge that they are, in fact, representative.
And that's incredibly hard. I mean, yes, we have to be very mindful of sort of who's really playing this role. I think it gets really complicated with illnesses that are stigmatized or just incredibly high risk, infectious disease. There's a couple populations where it really, I understand the desire to sort of be anonymous but still play a role, but these are just incredibly challenging issues. But I appreciate that. Yes, AstroTurf is, I've heard that vernacular before.
So with the DSMBs, you know, they actually say explicitly you can have what they call ad hoc members. And so I think from a policy standpoint, you know, you can just say we encourage, you know, the ad hoc members to be patients. Now, I agree. I haven't seen anything very good in terms of, you know, how you engage, you know, patients as DSMB members. But I think, at least at a higher level, that I think would be useful to lay out. Related to the IRB issues, I mean, there are a number of non-city IRB training programs that have been developed. And I think, again, you could provide links to those training programs on your website, or you could give those to investigators. And most of those do get approved by academic medical centers. And, I mean, if an academic medical center, you know, ever were to push back, you could also mention that a lot of international health research, you know, I don't want to say gets away, but, you know, allows investigators to get by with some different requirements for IRB certification of study personnel. So I think that there are ways that you can, you know, make sure that, you know, the patients and other stakeholders aren't subjected to the ungodly amount of hours that city training requires.
I have a couple comments, but just a question. What's the acronym you're using for the IRB training, city? What do you tell you? What is that?
So City is, I think it's based at, is it based at Duke now or in Florida?
I just know that for, I ask that because I know that for, is that, that's to sit on an IRB, not the, so to participate in research studies, let me just, and then a couple of the comments, but to participate in research studies, NIH has a relatively straightforward online training requirement that, to participate in any federally funded study, you have to participate in. That allows you to participate in any study funded by the federal government, and that then usually covers you in virtually any university setting to participate in research. I don't know if people consider that not plain language enough. It's actually relatively straightforward, so I may not understand these issues, but I just know that's a relatively straightforward way to do it. The other couple comments I just wanted to make quickly, one is just to appreciate your depth and sensitivity to the issues you're facing. A couple of quick things. We conduct focus groups, and I know some of the rest of you do in research all the time, that are on very sensitive topics. That so what we do with less experienced facilitators is we provide coaching and we provide text, we provide language. So something you might want to think about is just tools you share with investigators about how to say these things in respectful ways. It's just a tool you can share. We share it with facilitators because they're nervous about it too. What do I say when someone starts doing it? What if they keep doing it? What do I say then? We just created tools, language tools that help you facilitate that conversation you might be able to share. The other piece is because we have had patient participation and had my own challenges with IRB, I do think you should consider guidance for how to initially engage IRBs, what you can share with IRBs about the work that you're doing, and then also provide some templates for sharing their work with IRBs. The more we have discovered when we partner with people who then have to go to their medical IRBs because we're bringing patients in, we have just learned to share templates. And it just helps.
Okay, this is perfect. This is all I really, oh, we have more. We've got more. Keep going.
I just have one quick comment to add about the communication because that's, I think, again, going back to advisory councils, they really kind of laid some of the groundwork on that. And especially when you have very delicate issues or sensitive subjects, I agree that communication is, it is truly the best way to go about it. But I would also say not only communication tools, and we use communication tools as well in our organization, but for the facilitators, for the clinicians, but also part of training we use, at least at our institution, is for our patient and family partners in how to effectively communicate, and especially around sensitive subjects. You know, when what do you say when you don't feel comfortable speaking up about this? Or
so, just a last comment on training. On training, I'm not sure if you're aware, but Q, Consumers United for Evidence-Based Medicine, worked with the Cochrane Institute to put together some training
modules that are really, they were developed with a patient took the lead on that. So they're really very patient friendly and they're not too time intensive. And then the other point that I would make is, when do you need to get an IRB involved? I would think when you're forming a partnership is not the time to get an IRB involved. It's got to be when you're dealing with human subjects.
Thank you for, yes, the Q training I think could be really valuable, and the NIH training that Kristen mentioned, I think it might just be a question of familiarity for each, if the NIH training is something that tends to be sort of a blanket, all universities tend to accept it, that's one thing, but I think what we struggle with is familiarity among each PI or each team with these different modules and whether that's going to suffice for their particular requirements, but this is very, very useful. I can't remember now the second point that Lorraine made, but Regina, did you have a question?
Thank you. For providing this. Now, I want to say that I'm a six-year community member on an IRB, and I had to go through the city training, which I think is pretty difficult, but you have it to participate in IRB. But this is one of the issues we're grappling now with our patient engagement cluster advisory board. You know, our research partner is, we're trying to determine if we have to have IRB approval for some things, for even doing outreach into the community for our research awareness. So this is very timely, and I'm really glad for your guidance. And then we're trying to determine what's the best curriculum or training to use if we have to do it. You know, one of the models we're looking at is Dr. Emily Anderson's certification, you know, that she developed here out of University of Illinois Loyola. You know, we've used it before, and Emily presented it to us. So we think that's a good vehicle, but, you know, we still need to give. We need guidance from what you're doing now to determine which direction to go. So I want to thank you for this.
Well, we look forward to being able to provide guidance. It hopefully, maybe by the next time we see each other, we'll have some things on paper. All right. Thank you all so much. And we really will. This is just the start of this very long conversation, so we appreciate your input.
Thank you for allowing us to take you into territory that might be new to some of you, but, you know, as a community developed the rubric that was, you know, describing patient engagement in research, what we're doing is we're taking you into that square on the far right-hand side that was the conduct of research. So we're really taking you into when the actual research takes place and the issues that are coming up with the patient community and the research community about patient engagement. So it's very detailed, but these are the realities that are surfacing and that the fact that we're doing research with patients as partners has brought up new challenges and opportunities to help, put on the table. So we have, next on our agenda is call for topics, and this is the opportunity that people just share, maybe what they're doing. I don't know if we had anybody submit. Charlotte, do you have something to?
I'm going to address this here rather than try to use the prerogative of the chair. I think that we had a really great series of presentations and topics presented to us at this meeting, but I think far and away on that point too, we're at a midpoint as the for the 3-year cycle, and so we've done some great things. I mean, we've had some impact with respect to the rubric, and I think we haven't really sufficiently congratulated ourselves on the input that we've had on the evaluation process. I thought that was absolutely phenomenal because it said, among other things, that, you know, we are having an impact on, you know, broad policy that affects a number of us. And I'm going to keep this short, but Joe raised a point this morning in response to Steve's question about that really suggests what we need to begin to look forward to in the remainder of our 3-year cycle, and that is, how is engagement making a difference? Does engagement make a difference? Who better to answer that question than us. So I'd like to see us look forward to getting our points in around how engagement makes a difference. And, you know, anecdotally, we've all talked about it a lot in little ways with respect to the areas that we're most engaged in, and maybe we can begin to compile that and help to point the staff toward where to find evidence, you know, more concrete evidence and data that supports that. So that's what I have to say.
Thank you. Well, I think we can take this time. We'll just go around the table, and we have 15 minutes, so these can basically be your closing comments or whatever you want to share, reflections. Gail?
I just wanted to second what you were saying about the fact of evaluating engagement, and I would say that there's tons of anecdotal data out. What we need is our metrics that actually real data that we could point to. So I think we need to have some evaluation metrics for that PCORI puts down on engagement. If these are This is how we plan to go about evaluating whether or not patient engagement makes a difference, because that would be something that PCORI could really move the field forward on.
Yeah, I'm sorry you missed our presentation yesterday morning from our evaluation team that presented on an evaluation framework and a tool that they're implementing to create the evidence of engagement in research. And so,
because Joe this morning made it sound like that was something that was aspirational.
Yeah, no, we're actually there. It's something that we don't have any evidence yet. But the tool has been created. It has been sent out for our first few cycles, and they're actually collecting information right now to create the baseline. And so the process has begun. We just don't have any data yet to share. At the next PEEP, we will have data to share. We'll have some early findings, and again, it won't be enough to create evidence, but we will be sharing what are we learning from the field.
So first, I apologize. I'm going to make my comment and run because I have to catch a train to Baltimore. But just building on, I think, Charlotte's comment and the last day and a half, there's a lot going on. I mean, there are a lot of different presentations, you know, Suzanne's presentation, the presentation on PCORINET, the ambassador network, the evaluation. I feel like the evaluation work group and the compensation work group, when we met between meetings, that was very helpful. And I'm not suggesting that we add more work to our plate and have, you know, formal meetings, but I do wonder whether it makes sense for us to take the temperature of the group and think about, well, of all of these issues, of all of these topics, are there some that we feel are most important? I think evaluation metrics, you know, that probably is at the top of the list. I think I see heads nodding already and just from talking to people informally. But that might be useful for us. And I'm not saying we don't want to hear the updates every time we convene, but we may want to think about, all right, in a year and a half that we have left, what are other things that we really want to accomplish and maybe devote more time to during these meetings? So that might be something that we would want to think about in terms of how to check in with this group in the next few weeks so that the next meeting, which I think is in January, is really going to, you know, start to move us in the direction of making that last, you know, 18 months the most productive as we can.
Darius, can I just respond to that real quick, since I'm now the PEEP representative on the PCORI evaluation group, the PEG. I agree. It's such a critical issue, particularly, you know, with regard to, you know, showing what we've done in the reauthorization and all of that. But in general, larger, to show that patient engagement makes a difference and that everybody should get on board this train. With regard to the evaluation group specifically, I'd say it's been a little bit challenging. You know, I started to first get involved with the PEG in May And I think we had three meetings, May, June, and July, and then we hadn't met in August or September because of various calendars and conflicts. The evaluation framework is huge. It's broad. There's a lot of components and, moving parts to it. We only meet for an hour once a month, and, we have a conversation, but we're seeing things very compartmentalized, and it's hard to see how, things fit in with the big picture. So just for example, one of the things that we reviewed, this might have been either June or July, was providing feedback on the dashboard that, the Board of Governors reviews prior to, is available for the Board of Governors at all of the meetings. We're providing feedback and commentary on these things, but again, it's done in a very compartmentalized way, and it's hard to visualize how the pieces fit together in the bigger, broader picture. So, I'd like to be able to bring more back to the group, and particularly with the small group of us, the subcommittee that was, working on these things, but it's kind of been difficult to do so because I don't know that the process necessarily facilitates, an ongoing iterative review of, the big frame, because again, it's been carved out into little chunks and pieces, and we focus on one, then we shift and focus on something else. So I haven't seen that iterative update either at this point, and it's a big question mark.
And this is Sarah, as we worked on this, the recommendations that came from us back to PCORI, I think one of the clear messages was, from the evaluation framework standpoint, was that it does need to be put into a context that patients and patient groups can understand, because it's a tool for them to then be advocating for the value of PCORI as we get closer to reauthorization. So I think, while we understood that there were all these very nitty-gritty metrics in a very long document, it was, that's fine for internal use, but there also needs to be sort of an external use version of this that people can chew on, real people can chew on, and outside of people like me who, who can take this and use it, right? So that's my first comment. In terms of call for topics, I just would reiterate, too, I think I had mentioned yesterday that we did a roundtable with Families USA over the summer, and we actually did talk a lot about the topic solicitation process, and some of the suggestions, I don't have a topic suggestion, but just in terms of process, a lot of the groups were saying that, they do want to solicit to their members that PCORI is welcoming comments, but then what would be helpful is to have PCORI create a tool that perhaps, patient groups can put on their websites to help their members figure out how to condense their ideas into a topic, but that those kinds of tools that sort of help the patient groups do the work for PCORI in essence, right? That, it's PCORI's, but it's that PCORI's helping the groups get the word out about it and helping to provide the technical support for their members to then provide the relevant feedback. Just a very simple way to get the groups involved is to reach more patients and to get more topics solicited, the topics that are useful and put in the context that PCORI wants it put into. So anyway, that was a suggestion that was in our roundtable that I thought might be relevant here.
I would just note that I find it sobering when Stephen's basically saying he's struggling with Troy bringing back the evaluation piece. So that's it's a pretty smart guy. So that's a pretty big, strong take-home message. In terms of, that's scary, because if he doesn't understand, the rest of us are going to be completely lost.
Kim, when you were involved, did you have the same kind of experience on the peg? Okay, so it's not just me. Okay.
You're a smart guy. A very smart guy. I respect that. So I really appreciate the call for topics, and I appreciate your and Darius's call. I love the idea of some sort of intersection around what should be our priorities. And I do think this notion of topics, there is both sort of participating in the process of the measurement of the effect of patient participation on the outcomes of the research. There's the wider audience and the patients themselves. I think those are two important things for us to participate in. But I also think as PCORI is moving out into the world, these research networks are moving out into the world, our group needs to be focusing on these issues where we know patient uptake, receptor sites, interest is either going to make this fly or it's going to unintendedly hinder what PCORI is trying to do. You don't want to suddenly have us pushing all this out to then have patient communities going, oh, my God, what are you doing with my data? I think we need to think really carefully about where, as a PEEP, we have a unique perspective and insight and potential support to ensure that what PCORI is doing has the receptor sites and the uptake necessary, or we help them think about the things they need to be doing to ensure that unintended consequences don't occur from all the stuff we're suggesting they go out into the world and do. And that's the place we need to focus our energies and attention. Does that make sense? Yeah. Okay, thanks.
Any other thoughts? Sally?
Just one. I think that it came up so frequently in the last 2 days that it probably does bear some discussion somewhere along in the topics, and that would be an update on training. There's just been so many references to it, and poor Erica, every time she came up. So that just might be something that we need to have a better understanding of what are the, what's the scope of some of the training, how does it impact individuals who are participating, either as reviewers or maybe just getting some feedback and updates on that. But as you're going forward and further out, again, I think to Kristen's point, what is the sort of the impact on training that has communication mechanisms and methods and messages that maybe we could be informing on that could help with that training?
Just a couple of quick comments. Just a second, what Sally said, that the training, I think, is really a priority, and this group is really positioned to help with and to help advise on. And also as a new person, coming from the outside, who has been a part of a lot of these projects as a patient, as a parent partner, not having any of the, I don't want to use the word expertise because I have an expertise in my children's diagnoses. You have all, as a group, done tremendous work in terms of the engagement rubric and the We In Act, and it has really changed. I can tell you some of the way that researchers are doing things, at least some of the ones I see. So you really, as Charlotte said, you really should congratulate yourself because it is really wonderful work that in this short year and a half you've made a difference.
Yes. Also along the same lines, along with training comes certification of patient representatives on boards, on committees or whatever, who is an authentic voice for patients. We need to be able to answer that question. Because, as was pointed out here, we might have some people posing as patients. And in fact, everybody is a patient. But who don't have the patient's interest as their first priority.
Thanks, Perry. Actually, last night at dinner, we had a similar conversation about that. And it's a really hard track to go down, but I think that we as a group can and start talking about that more and more and just, what is and this is not just a problem with PCORI, it's an issue globally, I would say, when it comes to patient engagement and patient-centeredness and who is speaking on behalf of the patient and what is their agenda and are they speaking, are they really supporting the outcomes and that are important to patients? And honestly, after 15 years in advocacy, I don't know the answer to that, but it's something I think as a panel we should continue to talk about what is important to you all as we talk, say, patient engagement and what does that individual or that organization look like? It's a tough issue.
A couple quick comments. So first, I wanted to acknowledge both Amy and Kim who are not here and thank them for all of their input. Coming into an established panel, particularly, this group that's been together and been pretty tight-knit for the last year and a half could probably be a little bit intimidating, but it's great that we have new voices, new perspectives, and thank you, both of you, for sharing those. Second, I think some of the discussion we had around the subcommittees is kind of what I was trying to get to with Joe, and that's tapping into us a little bit more outside of these formal meetings and opportunities for us to be able to get involved. And if there are specific topics and issues that, you know, we can do some more thinking about, whether it's through a formal subcommittee or some other mechanism, you know, I think there's energy and interest in doing that. The third thing I want to mention briefly, and this relates to a comment Perry made yesterday, I think it would be helpful for this group to, you know, understand kind of where PCORIA is, both on an organizational level as well as from a research portfolio level, and going back to something like the dashboard or some other information, it may be useful when we meet in the future as part of our meeting materials to have, you know, in the briefing packet, a little bit status report. I think that'll answer a lot of the questions in terms of, you know, what's PCORIA doing, where is it at, you know, what's going on, you know, because I think there are a lot of questions about those sort of things, and I think it would be information that the group would appreciate. And then lastly, I wanted to share just a little bit about kind of my story and my recent journey. So I started a new job about 7 months ago. I'm now at GlaxoSmithKline, and I'm very happy to be there. The mission for GSK is to help people do more, feel better, and live longer. And GSK has a four core values that they really try to promote on a daily basis, and that's transparency, respect for people, being patient-focused, and integrity. And the reason that I bring this up is we've started, there's a lot of activity that goes on within GSK to try to be patient-focused, and there's a lot of different touch points. But we recently, over the last few months, kind of created a task force to kind of bring together some of those disparate efforts to try to understand, you know, on a larger organizational strategic level, are we really maximizing the relationships and these connections that we're making? So we're trying to work through some of these things, and I think we're referring to it as our patient-powered drug development initiative. And I really hope that I'll be able to bring some of you folks along in that journey to help us figure that out. So that's all I want to share.
Great. Yeah, thank you.
No, this is my second committee meeting, so this has been very enlightening for me. I actually am sorry I had to take a conference call in the middle of today's discussion, but, you know, I think that this is probably one of the more fundamental advisory panels that PCORIA has because it hits to the very core of how PCORIA does its business. So it's very different than the other advisory panels. I think the one that probably comes closest is maybe the one on clinical trials policy, which has a very global outreach. But this is, I think, by nature, very unique because it has an overall influence on all components of what PCORIA does as opposed to some of the very topic-specific advisory panel. So that puts you all in a very good position to have an influence on everything that we do at PCORIA.
Thanks, Jean. Charlotte, do you have any parting comments as chair?
Thanks and safe travel. Regina, hope everything goes well. Hope to see you with us again soon.
Thank you. And I would like to thank you. Every time we get together, I know my staff is, because we every day have questions about patient engagement at PCORIA, and we always say, well, we don't know, let's ask the PEEP. But you have helped us, you know,
bring patient engagement into PCORI, and we remain very, very appreciative. And thank you for allowing us to pull you in different directions and tap into what you know and what you don't know. I think going forward, I would really like to think about our next meeting and what do we want that to look like? And we've heard training, evaluation. I'd like to, most of you know Susan Hildebrand, my colleague who's sitting in back. She is the director of stakeholder engagement, the non-patient stakeholders. And, you know, we do have non-patient stakeholders on this panel. However, Susan works with a variety of other stakeholders who really are our partners in the research and in the implementation and the delivery of care. And something that that Susan has asked is, you know, what do you think about a discussion about what Susan and her team are doing with the other stakeholders? What is our relationship with pharma and with payers and purchasers and those who will be a part of research and a part of implementation? And so that's a dialogue that I'm asking if that's of interest to you. And so, Susan, not to put you on the spot, but I'd like to kind of have a vision of where we want to go next and start thinking about how we can best prepare you, maybe do something between now and then to inform you. So if there's any reaction to that, any thoughts about what you would like to see in the next round, please let us know. And we'll reach out to you. Rachel and I will work on some outreach to get, you know, grab some topics if you have some other thoughts.
Can I just add one thing before we leave and to get some feedback? One thing that I've noticed is that we really haven't, for the sake of full transparency, we get together, Darius and I, with Sue, and Sue's usually between meetings to talk about, you know, topics and, you know, what to do with the next meeting and that kind of thing, and really try to get to flesh out the agenda. And one thing that we really have not done in an organized manner at all is to include you in this. And I think the way that most organizations do this after a meeting is they have some sort of evaluation. So we're talking offline about doing some sort of informal poll, you know, not 19 questions in 15 minutes, but maybe just, you know, some outlet so that you can feedback what your thoughts are and recommendations are going forward. So I hope if we go through the trouble to do this, I really want to make sure that it's something you're interested in being responsive to.
So with that,
I have a parting comment.
Regina.
Remember me?
Yes, of course.
Yeah, just a few comments. You know, first I want to thank Sue, you, and Charlotte and Rachel for helping me, supporting me to participate offline. I really miss being there, but this was really helpful, and I hope that I helped as well. I also want to say that, you know, I am really grateful for all the work that not only PEEP is doing, but for PCORI as an organization. You've actually helped many communities, especially the underserved communities, really begin the journey to participate in research, not only being participants, but in designing. You've really, really awakened all of us to really get on board with this, because we've got responsibility as well. You know, we've got a door open, and we're actually really putting our feet to the fire to really get engaged. We've got a lot of good things going out this way, but as I can bring more information and resources and services from the meeting, participating in the meeting, you know, I will do that. But I really want to thank everybody, you know, and safe travels.
Thanks, Regina, for hanging in there for 2 days. With that, we can conclude, and we will look forward to January. I believe there's box lunches outside. You know, something I did forget to tell you. Mention again just for a second, something I forgot to tell you because we didn't have time, is we made an award recently to the Grand Challenge, the Matchmaking Challenge, and it is on, there's a four-minute video on our website if you want to see, but this is the app that actually helps match patients and researchers and clinicians and patients and clinicians and researchers, and it was actually awarded to a young man, I think he's, what, 24? A 24-year-old young man who has Crohn's disease and is part of our PPRN, and he won $100,000 to develop this app, and it's really quite intriguing, and I thought it was phenomenal that a young patient actually won this. So go online and watch this video. When he was made aware that he won this when he was overseas, so he got his computer and he videoed his announcement. It looks like he just woke up. I mean, say that online, but yeah.
That's great.